morning, everybody. I'm Nomalunge Lokini. I'm the member of the committee. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. My name is Suso Khadebe. What for the committee?
Morning. I'm Silence Makubela, a member of the portfolio committee as well.
Maya Tula is a name, member of the committee.
My name is Larry Bushman. I'm also a member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Alvin Potter. I'm a member of the committee. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Ellie Lottred, also a member of the committee.
My name is Crosby Money, a member of the committee. Tobe.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Zamaida Sokaisi. I'm the chair of NESFAS.
I'm Kotina Tikhena. I'm the CEO of NESFAS.
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm Nathan Johnstone. I chair the NESFAS Finance Committee.
Morning, Paul Whittle, Department of Higher Education and Training.
Morning, Tien Stradu, Higher Education and Training, CFO.
Morning, Vuyo Masam from Council on Higher Education.
Amadisa, Council on Higher Education.
Mark Hay, Council on Higher Education.
Thank you very much. Can we then go to NSM?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the invitation to present the NESFAS strategic plan and budget for 2012-2013 year. Firstly, I would like to reintroduce my team. I'm accompanied today by Mr. Nathan Johnston. He is the chairperson of the Finance Committee of the Board, which is responsible for overseeing the development of strategic plan and budget at NESFAS. And as he already indicated, next on my right is my Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Nkosinathi Khena. I think running late, that will join me, is the Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Msulwatak. Hopefully, he will come in very soon. But having said so, Chairperson, we are all pleased to have this opportunity today of engaging the Portfolio Committee on NESFAS Strategic Plan and Budget for the year ahead. This time last year, I sat before the committee as the new chairperson of the board of NESFAS. I presented a strategic plan and budget which included plans and an earmark budget for the turnaround strategy on which NESFAS had embarked in terms of the mandate given by the Minister of Higher Education and Training, Dr. Blake Zimande. We reported to the Portfolio Committee on progress of the turnaround strategy in the past year. Today, I would like to present strategic plan and budget for the coming year that will take the turnaround process forward as long-term and sustainable plan to transform NESFAS into a model, a public entity that is student-centered and geared to promoting our national development goals. We will present a detailed strategic plan for the 2012-2013 year, in which our priority is to complete the first year of the transformation process, which at the same time maintaining operation, distributing to student loans and bursaries that worth up to 7.4 billion. Chairperson, we will also go into some detail on how we plan to distribute this amount of student financial aid, which has more than doubled during the lifetime of the current parliament. Indeed, this year's budget will help us achieve the goal of both government and NSFAS, which is to increase the pool of funds available to students who want to study at university or college but would not be able to afford to study without this assistance from government. As the committee is aware, NSFAS has for the past several years been managing significantly increased funding on an old, outdated loan management system, it might be boring by now, that is no longer fit for the purpose of distributing more than 7 billion. During 2012, NSFAS will be implementing its strategy plan to put in place a new student-centered financial aid model. This will enable NSFAS to provide loans and bursaries directly to students at the 23 universities and 50 further education and training colleges in a much more efficient and effective way. The new state-of-the-art system will constitute the following. Will provide students throughout the country with NSFAS information while they are still at school. Don't want to start with them at universities, want to go to them at school. We'll have a central application process for financial aid. I was happy when the minister was emphasizing these things yesterday in his budget vote. We'll also identify which applicants are eligible for financial aid. We'll establish a direct relationship between NSFAS and students from the time they apply right through to the time when they finish their studies and start to pay back. Because for now, our strong relationship is between us and the universities. Then we want to go detail to students. We'll use a modern card system to distribute loans and bursaries money to students. We'll manage its direct relationship with students throughout the time they are studying. We'll recover its loans more efficiently, and last but not least, will enable NSFAS to comply with all its government legislation and regulations. Chairperson, the new model will also enable NSFAS to collect relevant information, analyze it, and report to oversight structures, including Parliament, much more effectively than in the past. Maybe let me, at this stage, honorable members, hand over to Mr. Johnston, whom I introduced earlier on. He's going to take us through to some few slides in the presentation on how the strategic plan and budget will achieve the first of these goals in 2012-2013. Nathan.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair and honorable members, I will be sharing the presentation with the CEO and CFO, so I'll hand over to them at specific points. I may also be sharing the presentation with a frog in my throat, so if you'll excuse the frog when he comes in at certain times. In terms of the presentation itself, we will start by contextualizing the NSFAS strategic plan and budget. We will discuss, give details of the strategic objectives and where it has been possible, where we can directly associate budgeted costs with specific strategic objectives. The presentation gives details of that. And then we will give an overview of the details of performance in the 2011-2012 financial year, specifically in relation to student loans and bursaries across various allocation categories. So if I could go directly to the strategic plan and budget presentation, we'll start with a vision and mission, an overview of the programs, and then we will have some discussion on the program strategic objectives, and then have a budget summary right at the end. This annual performance plan that we are presenting today represents year one of the MTEF period 2012-13 to 2016-17. It looks very different from previous strategic plans and annual performance plans because it has been developed in accordance with the National Treasury framework that all departments and public entities are now expected to implement. And I think most importantly, the strategic plan for the first time at NSFAS gives effect to the recommendations of the Ministerial Review Committee, and the chairperson has already referred to one of the key recommendations, that there should be a student-centered approach to financial aid. And as we will see later in the presentation, the strategic goals and strategic objectives have been drawn up in such a way to ensure that financial aid is, in fact, student-centered. The plan also aims to ensure that NSFAS is structured, governed, and resourced to fulfill its mandate in terms of the Act. So if we could go to an overview of the strategic plan. The strategic plan and the annual performance plan is guided by the NSFAS vision and mission, and those are on the slide in front of us. I'd like to focus very specifically on the mission and identify three elements on which the mission is based. Firstly, it says why NSFAS exists, and that is to provide financial aid to eligible students at public universities and FET colleges. Secondly, it says what it is that NSFAS does. We identify eligible students. It grants loans and bursaries to those students. It collects repayments on loans in order to replenish funds for future generations. And then the third element is the impact that NSFAS has on its constituency, and that is that it supports access to and success in higher education and training to students, as the NSFAS board chairman has pointed out, from poor and working class families, would not be able to pursue those opportunities without financial aid. And so it's very clear that the mission is now student-centered, the vision is student-centered, and the strategic outcome-oriented goals, of which there are three in the strategic plan, all work in support of that mission and vision. And so the first strategic goal focuses on the efficiency of the entity itself. The second strategic outcome goal speaks about access and success for the constituency that NSFAS serves. And the third one generally is an improved student financial aid environment. Chairperson, those three goals are organized into two programs, Program 1, which is administration, and Program 2, which is student-centered financial aid. And Program 1 really focuses on the services, the internal services that NSFAS provides to support Program 2, which is about getting money out to students, maximizing recovery so that we replenish the funds. The budgeted amounts that are allocated to these two programs are 104,645,000 rand for program 1, 53 million rand for program 2. Where does the money come from? The total budget is 157,654,000 rand. There are two sources. The first one is the DHET administration grant of 81.954 million rand, and the second is 75.7 million rand of the NSFAS transformation budget. There is approval for a total transformation budget of 98 million rand, and those funds came from retained cash surpluses in NSFAS that had not been committed to other programs. And then finally, the loans and bursaries budget for 2012-2013, as the chairperson has pointed out, is 7.4 billion rand. So 157 million rand to get 7.4 billion rand out to students in the financial year. Chairperson, in terms of the NSFAS departments in those various programs, in program one is finance, human resources, credit management, and information technology, and those are all internally focused business units. The externally focused business units are responsible for program two, that's loans and bursaries, customer care, which includes a call center, and communications, which is about getting information out to the market. I'd like to hand over now to Nkosinati, who will present the detail on the loans and bursaries budget.
Thank you, Nathan. Good morning, Chairperson, members of the committee, my colleagues from the department. Mine is to deal with the loans and bursary, which has been indicated that it will be around 7.4 billion. We have divided the sources of funding for loans and bursary into three. The first one is a section from the Department of Higher Education and Training. And the second section is from the Department of Basic Education, and the third section is the other sources of funding, which I will also deal with them in detail. We have categories of various funding within the Department of Higher Education and Training. We have what we call the general allocation. We decided to show you a comparison of the previous financial year and the current financial year. In the previous financial year, we had 2.4 billion. We also still have 2.4 billion. There's a small increase in that space. Final year funding, many of you will remember this particular program. It's a program that was announced by the Minister of Higher Education as well as the President of the country. And the particular purpose of this program is to encourage success of the students that are doing their final year. When it was first announced, it was 751 million. And we had to top it up based on the demand. We ended up in 2011-2012 dispersing 851 million rand. Again, as I indicated, there is a huge demand, and the purpose in this particular program is to encourage students to exit the institution, of course, from a success point of view. We have increased it to almost a billion rand. The second one is the teacher education. It has dropped slightly from what it was in the previous financial year. Student with disabilities, that one has increased. This is one area that the minister has also emphasized on, and yesterday, he urged all of us to be the ambassadors in this program to assist the disabled students. There shouldn't be any student that attends the university who is physically or anyhow impaired or challenged that should not get assistance. So if we all know students that are disabled out there, we should inform them accordingly that there is sufficient funding for them. We also have the FICA, which is a partnership. We intend to increase it to 34 million rand.
There is a Truth and Reconciliation a fund, and I must indicate that this fund has not been utilized in the manner that we would like it, but it's also based on the referral of those students who are affected or their parents were affected in the previous era. We also have the historic debt. It was a once-off funding. We do not have that funding this year. It's a historic debt relief. We have the FET College. You will see that the FET College funding has increased substantially. We also get funding from the National Skills Fund, and that also has increased reasonably. The Department of Basic Education, we've got a program that we are supporting, the Funza Lushaga Bursary. It moved from 464 million to 671. We also have other sources of funding, and they range from various departments, government departments, the first one being the Department of Social Development. In the previous year, it was 291. It has also significantly increased to 351 million. Department of Agriculture, it was 15 million, slightly, it has dropped to 9 million rand. It's a very small one from Communicare, 229,000, it dropped slightly to 200,000. We also receive funding from the Eastern Cape provincial government. It dropped slightly from 21 million to 19 million. We also fund NGO that we use as ambassador to reach certain areas that we might be challenged and asking them to assist our cause in reaching the students in the rural areas in particular. We have increased that from 12 million to 25 million. We also have one private sector, which is NetBank. They have indicated that they will keep their funding the same this year. There is also a special grant from the Department of Labor. This was a special project, and it is we are rolling over the funds whenever they have not been utilized, but as you can see, it's also a small amount. We, through the help of the Department of Higher Education, we are aggressively engaging with the CETAs for them to contribute in the funding of the students as well. In the previous year, we had 99 million rand that we received from them, and this year it's going to be 76 million rand. But we are continuously engaging with them, so we are hoping that there will be a change in the funding that we will probably get from the CETAs. The total, as it has been indicated, it is 7.4 billion. There is a difference of about 1.1 billion from the previous financial year. Thank you, Chair. Oh, sorry. There's just one slide. It's the performance on the loans and bursary. Although this specific question was not raised by the portfolio committee, but we thought it is proper, particularly in the government funding space from the Department of Higher Education and Training, we thought it would be proper that we indicate the performance in that particular category. We funded 121,000 students, to the value of 2.4 billion. On the category of DHE teacher, it was 4,950 to a tune of 104 million. Disability, we funded 1,064 students to a tune of 33 million rand. Finally, funding, as I have indicated earlier on, we funded 28,234 students to a tune of 851 million rand. DHET debt relief, 3,450 students to a tune of 52 million rand. We thought it would be proper to emphasize the performance in this particular area. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, the next couple of slides focuses on the strategic objectives for the administration program and the student-centered loans and bursaries program. The administration program proceeds from the premise that good governance is critical to NSFAS achieving its mission and vision and fulfilling its mandate in terms of the Act. And so we will see that the first strategic objective focuses specifically on governance, compliance with legislation, etc., but also deals with potential audit outcomes. The target is 100% compliance, and I think it's important that we explain why it's going to cost us 21 million rand to do all of this. Included in the 21 million rand is the cost of an external audit function, which is quite extensive and has a significant work plan during the course of the year to review various aspects relating to compliance, and that process feeds into the external audit at the end of the financial year by the Office of the Auditor General. External audit costs are also included in this amount, as are the costs for other compliance audits. During the previous financial year, NSFAS had the first compliance audit in terms of the National Credit Act, and that those audits will continue into the future. It also includes the costs of actual governance of the organization, as well as some of the components of the business transformation program, to ensure that we have the appropriate governance structures in place. One of the internal audit reviews focuses specifically on a review of the organizational governance. So governance in this NSFAS is assessed and a report is produced for the Audit and Risk Committee. The governance is dependent on policies and that roles and delegations in the organization are appropriate, and that is the second strategic objective. The next slide deals specifically with the policy frameworks, and so underpinning good governance is the need to have appropriate policies. Why spend 4 million rand on improving the governance system and dealing with policies? There's a policy development process underway, and we have identified that 116 new policies are going to have to be developed for the entity over the next 18 months. And that process has already started. It starts from performance management policies, human resources policies, supply chain management policy, information technology governance policies, etc. So there is a significant amount of work that has to be done in that area. The next set of strategic objectives moves away from policy, so we assume that we have governance in place, we have policies in place, and then starts to focus on capabilities. Capabilities in these first two, these two objectives for the people who work in the organization, so that we ensure that people have the appropriate skill sets, and that staff and that performance can be monitored and evaluated. members will note that we haven't indicated a budget allocation for one of these objectives. There is a budget allocation for it, but this is work that is going to have to go out to tender, and we didn't think it appropriate that the amount that has been allocated becomes public knowledge. The next objective, the first one on this slide, still focuses on the capability of people, and we then move to infrastructure capability in terms of the information technology architecture and infrastructure that is in place. The chairperson referred to a centralized application process, distribution, disbursement of money through a smart card system. So we need to ensure that we have the infrastructure in place that can do all of that. And then we continue to look at infrastructure capability in the next objective. And then the final one is really to develop and implement processes and procedures. So assuming that we have the infrastructure, the people, the policies, and the governance in place, the final step in this process is to implement processes and procedures to ensure that everything runs smoothly. And these two are also going to have to go out to tender. This program two is student-centered financial aid, and so the focus shifts from an inward focus on governance, policy, skills, and infrastructure to getting information out to students. And as the chairperson has indicated, the objective is not to wait until students stand in queues to register or to apply at university before they have their first contact with NSFAS. So the focus is going to shift from people trying to get into university to learners who are still at school, starting at the grade 9 level, where we need to deal with career guidance so that they can make the correct subject choices to enable them to get into university. We do intend to use new media here, so digital media, social networks, etc., to get those messages across to young people as well. The second objective in this program still focuses on students, so that we can ensure that the loans and bursary packages that we offer are structured to meet specific needs for students. The best and most obvious example of this is that a bursary package for a disabled student looks very different from a package for other students, because assistive devices have to be provided for example. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's segmenting the student population, identifying what the specific needs are, and tailoring those offerings accordingly. The central applications process is really about improving access, but also having a direct relationship with the student, so that the student applies to NSFAS for a NSFAS loan or bursary, doesn't apply through a university, have a relationship with the university, and NSFAS then has a relationship with the student through the university. So from the time of application, there's a relationship with individual students. The next objective is to broaden the scope for eligibility of funding, targeted student programs. The missing middle is referred to. The missing middle is really those whose family contribution or family income is above the threshold for current NSFAS loans. The majority of these young people's parents are public servants, who may not have access to private sector bank loans, and so there is a project underway to secure funding through a relationship with the Public Investment Corporation and the Government Employees Pension Fund to broaden the scope of available funds. Maximizing recovery, on existing loans is really to ensure that we recover as much as possible from people who have been granted loans, have graduated, become employed, and become eligible to repay. Recover as much as possible, as quickly as possible, so that that money can be reinjected for loans and bursaries for students following them. And then, again, to broaden funding categories for the remaining two objectives. And that's really to look at what the unfunded courses of study are, and then also new products for specific targeted student segments. The final slide in the presentation, Chairperson, is the budget overview, and Umsulwa Data will be speaking to that.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. I'll just be speaking to the last slide of the presentation to talk about the operational budget overview. As the Chairperson has indicated, during the course of the life of this Parliament, the funding that NSFAS administered has more than doubled. And this is the first year in terms of the ops budget that we're trying to bring in the effect of the increased budget into the ops of the organization. For instance, for compensation of employees, we're budgeting to increase from 24.2 million to 35.9 million. And this is the effect of we're now running with two shifts a day for capturing of loan application forms. If funding doubles, that means the number of loan application forms that have to be captured also doubles in the organization. That means we have got more staffing requirements that we have. But there is also a need for improved computer infrastructure. There is an increase from 3.3 million in the 2011-12 budget to 9.9 million in the 2012-13 budget. Also, in terms of the acquisition of new systems to be able to support the student-centered financial aid model, there is an increased budget from the previous year on business development from 9.8 million to 74.1 million. And this is the first year that the organization is now stepping up to make sure that it's able to have the infrastructure that supports a 7.4 billion rand disbursement. This organization in 2009 was disbursing about 3 billion rand, and it has been living with that infrastructure for the last 3 years. And we have now seen the effect of not beefing up the infrastructure, because the organization has to make sure that it delivers a quality product to students and is able to cope with the increased demands in terms of funding. The total budget for ops is budgeted to increase from 77.3 million in 2011-12 to 157 million in 2012-13. Thanks, Chairperson.
Chairperson, this is our presentation, and you can see that it's a new vision, new mission, but in line with the functions stipulated in the Act of NSFAS. We thought that what we're saying last year, you needed to see it in implementation. Money should follow student, and this is the approach that we're moving towards to. Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members.
Colleagues? Any questions or comments? Albina, Amukwele, Prof. Lodget? Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got very few things I want to get clarity on. The first one, Chairperson, is I think it's quite a good angle that they are getting into when they say everything, the financial aid, must be student-centered, as they have put it, as to say it needs to address the needs of the students. My question, Chair, will be one of the challenges that we hear about even when we go out on our oversight role is to say what causes the I want to use the word chaos, but these challenges that we have with the institutions, as to say they get the funding from NSFAS a little bit later than what has been expected during the opening of the year. These monies are not yet finalized as to when the students have received them. Is the whole question, Chairperson, of the year ending? That is, we find that the institutions will start from January to December, as we all know, and only to find that the financial year for NSFAS, it overlaps up until end of March, and we see that it's causing a lot of problems. That is why we find that towards the year ending of the institutions, that is where we find students getting these monies, and we even complain on issues of refund, of which I believe it's not a refund as we call it. It's when you give out the monies, and the student by then, they should have got other means of raising those funds. And we see by then it does not really fulfill the goal and the mandate of these monies that we need to find from NSFAS. So as to say, how can we make sure that the financial year and also the year, the intuition year, at least is something that goes parallel, so that we don't see this overlapping of the year, and also the way the funds are being distributed. Because really, if we leave it like that, it will always cause the problem that we see in our institutions, and seeing the suffering of our students not getting the necessary assistance on time. I'm also interested, Chairperson, in the dropping of the ring-fenced money for teacher education, as to say what could have informed that. Really, I think when we talk of teacher education throughout the country, it's one area that we need to see more funds, because we need to see the quality educators coming there so that they can deliver quality education. I'm a little bit disturbed if we can say the ring-fenced money for that has dropped. What might have informed such a decision? And also, there is an outcry, Chairperson, that the money that is ring-fenced for people for students with disability, it's not usually utilized. And we also say maybe it's not well known out there to say there is money that is ring-fenced for students with disability. And last year, only 33 million has been used, or was budgeted for. I don't know whether it was all used. But we find that it has been raised now to 63, almost double that amount, as to say, what is it that has been done by NSFAS to make sure that more of these students are attracted to utilize this money, because usually it's not utilized because of so many factors that you cannot even venture to today. We find that even in high school, we don't, little of them, they get out of matric, and there are so many factors of which I don't need to go into, but what is it that you have put in place for you to double that amount? Yes, we need to see people with disability utilizing this, and we have been failing to do that throughout the years, but now, for you to double it this year, what has informed that? Let me stop there for now, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just a few. The first from me would relate to the issue on conversion of the loan into bursary by those who complete their final year, whether it is being implemented, and if there are challenges, what are those? Because there has been that particular indication or declaration, and there seems to be issues, and we must understand what the challenges are. The other chair is to understand whether there is some consensus with institutions of higher learning on the central application of the financial aid. I'm not saying they should have got a right to say don't or do, but there must be some engagement, because I think there are implications in that regard. I take it that they should be able to apply even before they get to those institutions. And they will apply before they've got admission or and so on. So there must be some engagement with institutions of higher learning. How are you going to be addressing that? All I'm asking is whether there has been some interaction to see this is the route we're going. What will that be on your side as institutions? So that there's no problem. Because even if you were to grant that, you must grant that after admission and so on. So there must be issues there. There's been an issue that even those students who are supposed to benefit from NSFAS, they are required to pay upfront registration when they go to these institutions. Or rather, let me put it this way. Institutions do not apply the same policy with regard to this particular money from NSFAS. Some insist they must pay something. Well, it links with the fact that those institutions will then say, we receive this money a bit late and we need operational funds between January and March before we can even get our allocations. I know there are responses, but the issue is, if these learners or students do not have anything and are required to pay upfront before registering, there is a serious problem in that regard. How are you handling that? My last but one, Chair, on data integrity or your tracking system. It was part of you being able to maximize the collection must be based on your data, whether you are able to tell where the students are, or if you are unable to do that, it means some may go away without being able to pay. Because if you would rely on those employed by government only, but if they work in the private sector, perhaps you are not able to pick it up, depending on where they are employed and so on, then that system is flawed or has got its own challenges. All I'm saying is, are you able to track everybody within your system? Chair, I was also interested in understanding what informed the historic debt, what sort of debt was that could be handled once off in that particular year. What was the target? Didn't that have any outstanding challenges or backlogs that went beyond that financial year? I think you were handling that on 11-12 and 12-13, you're not allocating anything. My understanding is whether you were able to wipe off that particular debt, which was informed by whatever historical or legacy matters. What were those? We may need to be reminded, Chair, even if by then you might have presented to us as to these are the challenges. But it's good to refresh our memory so that we know whether we're sitting with other problems or not, and whether they are filling all the vacancies if there are part of the administration, whether you have that capacity.
Professor Lotrit?
Thank you, Chair. First, just another comment. How I wish your slides had pages so that I could refer you to page 7, 9, 11 for when I'm asking my questions. And another technical question. On your slide, your strategic plan overview, your numbering there, your 7 billion looks like 7 billion. I don't know if you get what I'm saying there. If you look at the figures before and your 7 billion looks like 7 million. Your central student-centered system reminds me of the structure I was in the 80s. It was Education Development Trust. Education Development Trust. We used that and we had regional offices where students were applying so that I would and report to the national. Seated where I'm seated now, I'm still not sure how this central student center is going to work. Where the student at Meleni is going to apply, they apply to center. And I'm not sure, Sidiraj, again, when we're practical and I'm looking through your program as to when that actually is going to happen. When are they going to be doing that? Say, we have been telling students everywhere, don't worry, just go to the university, go to the office, they give you the number, and we're saying we're changing that. It is very important for us, as we're going to be going to the constituencies, to tell them what actually is expected of them. If I go to your slide, I don't know what to call it. Your slide on, let me start your slide on program to student center financial aid. You have your strategic objective and your performance indicator. When I look at your performance indicator, you are saying consult with digital media provider. Tender issued for a new digital media program, February 2012. And appointment of service provider. I'm just curious to know, we're now in April, whether that has happened. And you go to the next, when you say target, your target is a broad target. You say 2013, 2012, 2013. I cannot check as to whether you did it or not, because, well, 2012, 2013 could be anything. Could be June, could be May, could be February next year. If you go to the next slide, again, it is slide on program two, students, just the same student-centered financial aid. I'm just curious about that DTEC. You say develop a new program for unfunded courses of study. Unfunded courses of study. I don't know what that means, because bursaries are for, it's just a clarity on that. And you are saying in particular, this is, we're going to fund a new BTEC funding program by June 2012. Again, I don't know what that means. The students are in institutions of higher learning as we speak. And if you are saying something is happening by June 2012, what does that mean? The new BTEC funding program by June 2012. That was the question. If I go to the budget overview, I'm curious to get the percentage of your compensation for employees. Yes, it has jumped from 24 to 95 to 35 920. I'm curious to get the sense, what percentage of that, of your bigger slice, what percentage of that? Again, for that sense, student-centered, are we going to be having regional, district, what have you, how practically is that going to be implemented? Thank you, sir. Abangulu, can you just, some of us come from constituencies. When they say Katabangulu, I really say Dujo. What project is that? Why did it land in Tabangulu? Can I pull it to my own constituency? What animal is that?
Thank you, Chair. I think quite a number of the questions that I wanted to ask have already been asked. So I only have one left, and it also relates to the central application process. I am a bit concerned with a central application process, because my experience has been with students who are first-time students, they're first-generation students. They're very uncertain of how processes work. And my experience has been that even with financial aid officers, they don't quite understand the processes and they have to be taken by the hand basically to apply and what is needed, etc. Do we have a guarantee that that kind of assistance will be available for students when you have a central application process? Because I've in fact had situations where if students hadn't come to me to assist, they would just have left without going to the university because they were under the impression they don't qualify for NSFAS funds.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Good morning. And if I was in Germany speaking after two professors, I would be called Professor Professor. Chair, mine, you see, also I have some few issues on the student central allocation system. Maybe we might need time as a committee for NSFAS to come and present to us only this aspect to say, what do you mean on this thing? It looks like a nightmare because you have to have massive capacity to deal with this challenge, in particular if the intention is to broaden access. As NSFAS is just reporting now, there are already allocated bursary schemes, like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, like the bursary for people who are indebted, in which we have not been able to distribute that sufficiently because of our inability to reach out to these people. Now, we have a centrally run financial aid where people, in my imagination, go directly to NSFAS. What mechanisms are we going to use to make sure that everybody understands what we're supposed to do? Do we mean that we are moving the administrative offices that we'll find, for instance, in Vates, Nelson Mandela University, where people can walk in and go to the office and inquire? Does this mean that we students will have to call Cape Town, or students will have to forward their applications to Cape Town? What mechanisms of accessibility? Therefore, you have to break this thing for us down. Are moving away from the capacity of the current institutions that they have in running this, or we're saying these institutions are not doing well in terms of administering NSFAS. I would request that NSFAS maybe one of the days come and say, this is what we're talking about, this is a system. Because what you are proposing, you might have students now no longer toying in a vice chancellor's office, going directly to NSFAS office. Maybe also you are relieving institutions of that burden. And can you take that? The bursary for the minister raised this issue, and I was very concerned when he raised it. What's the problem? Is it your marketing mechanism, or have you been engaged to a robust marketing where you tell South Africa that there's this offer? There are many people sitting in rural areas and in our locations who have graduated some long time ago, but because universities are still keeping their certificates, they will not access them. Once there is this bursary that has not been exhausted. Therefore, I want to suggest, please, man, I've seen departments, just a person or a minister advertising himself or herself. This can be advertised on national television. Let us not only use print media. Our people use radio and communicate this positive message that is there. Believe you me, it will reach the poor of the poorest from corners where they cannot be reached. And if you have done that, tell us if you have done that. The other interesting bursary that I see here is the one for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It reminds me when I got a call from the Mthimkhulu family in 2005. When was this? You see,
did this start maybe 2 years back or before 2005? And there are many of the victims of apartheid. What criteria possibly to use? Only the people who appeared in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or all victims of the apartheid system? And please, man, if again you could explain to me, do you only rely to the information you get maybe from the Truth, then Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Because I believe, having met with many South Africans who are affected in this part, there are many victims who can benefit out of this. Can we check up the manner in which we market some of this bazaar? This is the most important bazaar that we should be talking about. Eastern Cape. Why the Eastern Cape government is the only one? When I was still in the Eastern Cape, I think by the time of Professor Mayatula and the other MECs, I know that the government of the Eastern Cape was contributing, decided to take the fund, the bursary fund from the Premier's office directly to institutions. Tell me, why is it because it's only the Eastern Cape government that has the bursary fund administered by NSFAS, or it's only the Eastern Cape government that is willing to contribute and assist students from the Eastern Cape? What about other provinces? Are they administering their own bursary schemes, or are they giving it to you as NSFAS, and those do not appear here? Those are a few clarities, Chair, that I wanted to get. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first issue is around auditing. I find that it is part of your administration, and its costs are included in there. But I would imagine that auditing is an item that is monitored. Then if it is part of your administration, how do you monitor it? Number two, I have missed provision for legal expenses. I would imagine that you have contractors and consultants. What would you, wouldn't you go to court in case of a dispute? Or, I mean, are legal expenses part of your special services? Lastly, on your last slide, there is, on staff education, you have training. Then on policies, procedures, you also have training. What's the separate? And then lastly, Chair. On business development, last year you had something like 9.8 million. This financial year you have 74.1 million. Is that not a big jump? Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson, for the second opportunity. I'll be very short. The first one, Chair, that I thought other members will touch on it, the issue of the missing Mickey. Of which I think it's quite an important area to look at. Those people, you know, have been suffering quite a lot. If ever I can get more clarity as to saying when can we see that funding that is being initiated being fully implemented? Because yeah, they are suffering. Coupling with that one of BTEC, as to say finally, do you have an agreement as to saying yes, we are going to find BTEC, since there has been that argument of BTEC is in the second qualification on top of diploma, as to say how have you resolved that? Are we really going to see it being implemented by June 2012 as it has been reported? Secondly, Chairperson, the issue of indebted students. We have got a report from HISA last week saying there are very few students that are coming up for that intake, where we saw about 3.5 students out of
almost 25 students that are indebted, and only 52 million has been used in that effect out of the... I'm interested to see what was the budget initially, and also we know about the 200 million that has been budgeted for. So last year, what was the budget for that, and what is it that is happening? But from HISA, that is the report that we got, that there is no upcoming of the students to take that offer that has been made for them. Chairperson, I'm just about to finish. There was this refund from the NSFAS that we were talking about last year, where they were refunding or reimbursing the students that were overcharged in the past years. How far are you with that? How far have you budgeted it for? Have you started to roll out the process? If ever there are challenges, what might be the challenges? Because there was sort of an announcement that was made, and wherever we go, you know, as members of parliament, we are public representatives, we are asked about these things, only to find that sometimes we don't have a very concrete response to give to the public, because there's so much that people are waiting from you to get into their pocket out of the monies that have been deducted from them in the past. And lastly, there was this talk of smart card system that you need to work around. How well can it benefit us? The issues of monitoring. Can tell us more about the smart card system that NSFAS is about to introduce. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. I think most of the questions have been covered, but I would just like to get some more information on. And one of the questions at the back was on legal fees, but I see in the one of the programs under student-centered financial aid, there is on the object of outstanding loans, the recovery of outstanding loans. There is a quite a big number budgeted for a new setting up of a new system. The 18 million, or is it the cost of recovery? And then maybe if you can just give us information on what is the policy on outstanding debt? Is there interest and recovery cost also covered by the debt, or is it for the for NSFAS's account? Thank you, Jim.
Comments and other elements and questions and answers. Can I give Khadebe or can I allow them to answer? Maybe in the answering process, there could be answers to unasked questions. Yes.
Chair, thanks very much. A lot of questions, but it's fine. Let me apologize upfront, Chair, in terms of 7 billion appearing as like 7 million. I think that is correct. We should have put that at the top. So we apologize on that one. It's not correct to put numbers in such a manner that they are misleading. There was no intention. Throughout, we've been talking about 7 billion. Let me clear that. But I'm going to hand over a lot of questions. Nati, this you.
Thank you, honorable members. My colleagues will add in some of the answers that I'm going to be giving to the members. I think the first question was raised as to the challenges during registration. And also, again, another member raised the issue of inconsistency in the application of standards. Other universities are doing this and others are doing this. I'd like to deal with those two in that particular session. Members will recall that the last time when we were here, the very same question, if my memory serves me well, was asked in terms of how we are assisting. There is a general agreement with the institution that NSFAS will give them 30% of their allocation as upfront payment. And this is to assist the registration of the students. That students can get books in the meantime, they can get accommodation, they can get meals. It is intended to do that. Again, as the member has indicated that there is inconsistency in how these things apply. There are some universities that also do not apply for upfront payment. And the reason they do not apply for upfront payment is simply because once they have assessed the student and they see that the student does meet all the requirements for funding through NSFAS, they simply register the student. And one of the universities that comes to mind that does that is the Venda University. But yes, there is inconsistency. And when we had the workshop with the financial aid offices, this is one of the areas that we were addressing to them is the standardization of processes, is ensuring that there is compliance into the policies of NSFAS and procedures of NSFAS. So yes, it is a challenge, but we are addressing the consistency and standardization throughout the institutions. The second question was around the drop in the teacher funding. I see the member shaking. The second question was around the funding for teacher education, that there was a slight drop in that one. I think that one needs to be looked at in relation to the Funza Lushaga, because the Funza Lushaga does exactly the same funds the teachers as well. And if you look at it, it has gone up quite significantly from 464 million to 671. So there has been an increase and they are covered. And there are also other funding from NSF which we have grouped that also take care of the teacher education as well. The issue of disability, it is a concern. There is a strong belief, and particularly amongst all of us, that there is quite a number of disabled people out there. Hence, the budgeting is like that. The minister has raised this issue as well. We have engaged with the DPSA to see how they can assist us in this space. They have also indicated that there is a forum of various disabled constituencies. And today, during the course of the year, they are going to be introducing us to that forum so that we can also engage with them to that forum. But in our discussion with DPSA, something very interesting was raised, was that even if we are funding some of them, our funding does not take care of their needs because they need additional support. And in terms of our mandate, we have not extended the scope to fund in that. And it's a policy matter, and we need to engage with the Department of Higher Education in that particular space. That's just one area that they raise. But we are all out there engaging. We are even going to the schools, special schools, engaging in that particular space to see how we can assist. One of the things that we have picked up is that many from the schools, the very few that come to higher education, and that becomes a challenge. But we are pursuing it, and I think it does need a proper research so that we deal with the issue once and for all. The conversion of final year bursaries, yes, from loans to bursaries, that does take place, and it is the intention for this particular program. We get information from all the universities. They supply us with proof that these students have passed, they are going to graduate, and we convert their loans accordingly. There was a question as to whether there has been any consensus with the institutions in this regard. Our relationship with the institution, I think maybe we also need to refer to the Act. If you look at Section 20 of the NSFAS Amendment Act, it also allows us to use the institution as agency. Therefore, the decision rests with us. But that doesn't mean that you don't consult stakeholders simply because the decision rests with you. What we have done through the workshops, we had a workshop in February. We engaged with the financial aid. We even took them through our operating model and our strategy that we intended to implement going forward. And I would also like to deal with the issue of how well this particular strategy is going to be applied. More work needs to be done in that particular space. More engagement still needs to be done in that particular space. There's also engagement with the central application. There's a pilot in KZN, and we are working with the Department of Higher Education in understanding and evaluating and begin to take some lessons from that particular situation as well. So, yes, at a later stage, as the member has said, we might have to come back once we have crafted it and we are clear in terms, and even beginning to understand further cost implications in terms of regionalization. The centralization basically says they will now be dealing with it, but there could be channels in various areas where that we are going to have for them, for the students to engage with us in various regions. Can I pause there so that my colleagues can continue? I'll also continue. I just want to drink water in the meantime.
Chair, I'd like to just continue on the central applications process. One of the projects that is underway at the moment is a financial aid office link being piloted in 5 universities. The central applications applications process at the moment works in the following way. Student cannot apply directly to NSFAS. The student has to apply through the financial aid office at the university. They fill out a loan application form. The information is loaded onto the university's ITS system. The loan application form then gets sent to NSFAS manually, so it gets couriered in a box, and the boxes pile up at some of the universities until June or September of a particular year, gets sent down to NSFAS, and our data capturers have to capture all of that information again. What the Financial Aid Office link is doing, that is the first step in the central applications process, is that there's an interface between the NSFAS data system and the university data system, so that when the data is captured in the financial aid office, it is immediately available to NSFAS. So the financial aid offices will continue to fulfill that agency role of the acquisition of students. students, and they would be able to give guidance to students. In addition to that, the part of the plan is that there will be other channels that students can utilize. One of the channels that we are looking at is the post office, because every little town should have a post office, so that the student can go in, get the information there, and that they can then be directed to a particular place where they can get assistance, where they can be guided through the process. And yes, the idea is that a student can apply before they go to university, so they don't need to be able to prove that they've been accepted. What is key to this concept is that the money follows the student. That NSFAS is no longer going to be making an allocation to a university. NSFAS is going to be informing universities. The following students have applied and have been approved for NSFAS funding. But the financial aid offices will continue to play a role there. I think that's the key part of the central applications process. It doesn't mean that students are going to apply directly to NSFAS. It's really the information technology platform that is going to be centralized.
Thanks, honorable members. I'll deal with a few specific questions. The first question that I will tackle is the question on the refund project that we announced last year. The refund project, there was an accrual for the refund project of about 77 million. It affected 34,000 NSFAS debtors. Up to this point, we've refunded 19.6 million rand out of that refund project. Naturally, with projects like these, you get people who don't reply back when they were sent the SMSs. They probably think this is a hoax SMS and they just don't reply back to claim their money. But those that have replied back to claim their money were in the process of refunding them. We have now have got about 1,900 debtors that will be refunding in the next 3 weeks, which is the last group of debtors that have already claimed their refunds and submitted all the required documentation. It's going fairly well. The next question that I just want to tackle as I'm on this issue, I think, is the question around the compensation of employees as to why the jump and what percentage of it of the big cake. The compensation of employees is budgeted 35.9 million on the last slide, which is slide 19. Out of the total ops budget for the year, the compensation of employees is about 22%. But out of the total cash handled by an NSFAS, it's 0.4%, the compensation of employees. I just wanted to give the context as to. But the jump also, if you look at the jump on the consultants, because NSFAS was in transition, there's been a big use of consultants and contractors. There's a decrease on the use of consultants and now an increase on the use of internal employees. That's the plan, because now NSFAS is recruiting its own employees, its own executives to do the work rather than outsourcing the work. Training budget, there's a question around why we use training in two different areas, and that I think that was just an overemphasis. The general training of staff sits with staff education, training and development. But because there's a specific project on new policies at NSFAS, we have to emphasize that after we've done the policies and the procedures, we have to train people so that they don't just sit in a file somewhere in a box and no one knows what the policies are. The general training sits with staff education, but the other training is specific to that line item on policies and procedures, which we thought is an important element of the new strategy. Business development has jumped. That's the next question, from 9.8 million to 74.1 million. The major impact on the jump of business development is the whole transformation project, the whole discussion around the student-centered model. There's a new IT model that is also built into that. There's a lot of work that is going to happen, and I think Nathan will just add on this one before we focus, because I think that's the core focus of operations for the coming financial year. And maybe before Nathan, I must just go into the next question. That said, on the recovery, we're budgeting about 18 million rand for the activity of recovering money from NSWAF debtors. Part of that money is the cost of running the customer care center that does, you know, phoning people, trying to trace people, trying to recover the money that is owed by NSWAS. But and then the support services of running that that contact center to try and trace and trace the debtors. But the other question that I will just tackle is, what happens to recovered funds? Once we've recovered these funds, what do we do with these funds? If you remember when the CEO was presenting last year, in terms of the budget that we got from higher education, we got 751 million for the final year program. But the demand was 851 million. That's where those recovered funds come in. The 100 million, which is the difference between what we got from higher education and what we eventually paid, comes out of recovered money. And every year, the board allocates those recovered funds to top up where there is any gaps in terms of funding. The recovered fund is then plowed back into the student.
You say the relations with SARS, okay, no, people that are employed from day to day, of relations with Home Affairs, you know who died yesterday, who's your data, and so on.
Chairperson, firstly, there is a requirement in terms, there's a provision in terms of the NSFAS Act that SARS will inform NSFAS. So we send a schedule of students who have been awarded loans. SARS then matches that using ID numbers against their system. As soon as a person has been registered as a taxpayer, SARS then notifies NSFAS. They are able to inform us as to who the employer is, etc. So that's the first step in that process, and that's the mechanism that has been used largely up to now. I think the significant change in the new operating model in terms of the student-centered approach is that up until now, the student has had a relationship with the university, not with NSFAS. Even though they've got a loan and their relationship with NSFAS extends far beyond the date on which they leave the university. The intention is that NSFAS establishes the relationship with students from the time they apply for a loan, and that we maintain that relationship with them beyond when they've exited the system. The new information technology platform will make that sort of relationship possible. And I think the key to successful tracking is relationship. And one needs to start very early on to build that relationship. There's no point in not communicating with a person for the 4 or 5 years that they are at university, and then suddenly 2 years after they've left university and they are now registered as taxpayers, they get a message out of the blue and say, oh, by the way, do you remember me? Your long-lost cousin, you owe me some money. And so it's relationship rather than tracking, and it's about maintaining that relationship that's important. Chairperson, I'd also just like to deal with the increase in business development costs. I think an important point to make here is that the bulk, significant amount of money in this total budget of 157 million rand is not recurring costs. So if we look at slide number 7, page 7 in the pack, the recurring costs will be in, is part of the 81.954 million that comes through in the DHET grant. The 75.7 million is once-off costs for the 2012-13 financial year only. When we come back here next year, we will see a significantly reduced amount allocated to business transformation. And once that project is completed, we will then revert back and only the DHET administration grant will be our recurring cost. So the baseline is not changing. These are once-off costs, and a lot of it relates to the acquisition of the new information technology platform.
Thank you. If I may continue with some of the questions as well. There was a question around the historic debt relief in relation to historic debt. Historic debt relief was a request from specific institution, and I guess this is how the whole thing of historic debt came to the fore. And that is why, if you look at that particular line, it is ending. We do have funding for historic debt. Historic debt funding sits in the National Skills Fund. It is in there because they are specifically funding that particular aspect of historic debt. The filling of the vacancies. We are aggressively trying to fill all the vacancies, particularly the ones for executive. The chairperson on this particular space is breathing on my neck to say we should be filling these vacancies. However, I must just indicate that whilst we are aggressively recruiting for them, we sit in a government situation, and we're competing because our activities are those of the financial sector kind of situation. So we are competing, and we wanted to get people from and that are competent to run this to come to our institution. They are sitting in banks, they are sitting in insurances. And therefore, there is a bit of a challenge in doing that. We are discussing other strategies that we need to employ to be able to attract these people to come into our space. But we are aggressively pursuing that one. The BTEC aspect. They are unfunded. We have been engaging with the department in this space. They have indicated that, unfortunately, in this financial year, they will not be able to assist in that space. But we are engaging with other institutions and even other government departments to assist in the funding of that. We are currently in discussion with one. You know, in my culture, they normally say don't count them before they are hatched. So, I don't even want to sound like it's going to be a done deal. So we are still negotiating, but we are hoping, and we are aggressively trying to get funding for the BTEC students. The whole issue of communication. This is one area that we are focusing on.
Sorry, Chair. Just on the BTEC, is that uniform? Is that uniform that BTECs are not funded? Uniform in all universities? Because when did it start? Because I know of people who are funded in BTEC. I know of universities currently, last year, who funded students who passed their national diplomas to BTEC through NSWAS. Is that what is happening in the country? Or your understanding, but on the ground, it's not happening that way?
I'm going to be very careful in answering this particular question. We do not have a particular and a specific category for funding BTEC. I do not know what is happening from other institutions. It is supposed to be uniform. But you could, the honorable member could assist us, because that talks to the issue of standardization and the things that other institutions that are doing. We're going to be visiting institutions. We are going to be having regional workshops dealing with this issue of standardization and these other slight deviations that are not supposed to be there that tends to creep in. We are also going to be using our internal auditor to start visiting these institutions. We are currently scoping.
Just to help the CEO, I think this question is a policy matter that we must engage with, because we don't say don't fund them. I know that from the ministry and the department, there seems to be a view that there is a mission drift in universities of technology, comprehensive universities, to offer programs that are best suited in traditional universities. Secondly, when we ask something that perhaps there should be policy intervention to say, should we exclude people that have got diplomas that they would like to upgrade them to BTECs? That is the question that perhaps you must debate at level as NSFAS and come back to the committee as to what your position is. So if in some universities there is that funding, we welcome it, because we do not want a distance. So that must be very clear from us. If other institutions are funding such people, we are happy, because that's what we want. And we just hope that as NSFAS, you can analyze that and check how you could play a role, or tell NSF to do something better of that nature, unlike focusing on short courses. That's our point here.
Chair, we're not going to go beyond your clarity. I think it's helping us.
I'm saying that clarity is confusing me, because if a university funds BTEC using NSFAS funds, it's not university, it is NSFAS. Either NSFAS funds or doesn't. See the way I'm sitting, I'm getting confused. Who is funding? Because if university decides to say, when you are doing your BTEC, I'm going to give you 20 rand, NSFAS funded. And the policy of NSFAS says, I don't fund BTEC until policy is clarified. That is where you should be.
So you want clarity on that aspect?
Yes, the NSFAS should know they are either funding BTEC or they are not. Not tell me that there are students or universities that are funding BTEC through their money.
Chairperson, I think I could possibly clarify this. NSFAS has agreements with a number of universities where the universities allocate some of their own money to fund certain students. These are called institutional loans. What they do is they identify the students. The students then complete a NSFAS loan agreement form, and the loan is registered as a NSFAS loan. NSFAS administers that loan and is responsible for recovering the loan on behalf of the university. But the funding is actually made available by the university, and there are contracts in place with all the universities for this. So the universities could be funding those students, but the money is not coming from the NSFAS budget. It's coming from their own allocations.
Okay.
universities themselves, because students have been complaining they are not being funded. Now, universities were saying we are unable to fund this, which perhaps they were saying that on behalf of NSFAS, because they regard that as two programs, not a single kind of a degree, because you then have to first do some two-year diploma and then have an additional later on, which was not able to be one particular program. So at the policy level, is that it's not been funded. So that's what we know, that NSFAS does not pay. Most universities are using that as well to say this can be funded. So that's what we know. And that's why if there's a breakthrough, we become happy, because we've been even pushing the department to saying, how do we handle this particular matter? You know? Now, if there's a particular way or mechanism, creatively so, being done or having been initiated by one university, perhaps it's a model that we needed to understand, you know, more. But there's need for a policy directive that says, yes, our systems are able to take through, to take on board these kind of students. Because otherwise it will mean others are suffering, others whatever. There's no real clarity. Because what I'm getting even here is that NSFAS does not know itself to be funding that. But somehow, indirectly, they may be funding if a particular university has some creativity in that regard without them knowing. So at the policy level is that there's no funding. And we must ensure that there's funding, you know, for those particular students who must be able, the system should recognize those, that category of students as those that can as well be able to benefit. Because anyway, they qualify, but in terms of how the degree itself, the program is structured, they get excluded on that particular basis.
Chair, lastly, Chair, you see, NSFAS is part of this confusion. There is policy that is regulated in place on how funding should be allocated in institutions in general. Now, there is a certain arrangement. You know the danger of this arrangement. Now, I come from a university that used to do this. I come from, and it's a better historical advantage university. But this arrangement, to Mangosuthu Technikon, to never have worked, because they are not resourced to fund, if they fund. But I want to settle with the response of the CEO that we need answers in this regard, because this practice has been happening for a very long time. The understanding of ordinary students on the ground and in the university, it's not communicated, as the other gentleman is saying, that NSFAS funds the BTECs. Now, the audit that we are talking about, CEO, to say what is happening generally in the country, because seemingly there's no understanding, even in the institution, on how this should work relating to police, should be done. You must know which institution has been offering this and which institution have not been offering. Therefore, I would need that kind of a report in particular in relation to this matter. I agree, we'll discuss police. But policy is going to take a very long process. If we have to make a general arrangement for all institutions in this country, including the disadvantaged, we must say that we are making that arrangement. And how do we assist them, those institutions who cannot afford, like the Nelson Mandela University, like UCT, and many other universities? Therefore, I'm trying to say the audit approach, it will be the best approach to me.
I'm at pains to put a message across that this is a policy matter. And as a committee, we might not decide policy, but we can shape and influence policy. And we say it could be better if there is funding of BTEC. That is our view. We can't, at our level, take a decision, because that is the area of the minister. In fact, if you could engage the minister in private, he might say, in his political mandate. We would like that to happen, and many students would be very happy. Can we allow you to then, at one level, because
you are the ones with power in terms of the law as I know it to deal with that matter. I'd like you to think about it and make a determination. Can you proceed on other aspects? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. With regard to...
That one is a clarity, I'm sorry. That's one bite, that is the last one. See, I'm trying to be comfortable with this policy, whatever you call it. I would have thought a BTEC is a junior degree, like a BCom, like anything. And therefore, NSFAS funds junior degrees. And we have poor students who do these diplomas, want to finish, not a postgraduate, but a BTEC. Sitting where I'm sitting, I just cannot understand under what circumstances was BTEC defined otherwise, so that this poor student who wants to do his BTEC is not allowed to.
I think the advancement of Professor Mayatula is exactly the approach of the committee, because as we fail to understand the distinction of this diploma with an additional year that makes the student to have a BTEC. Yes, definitely. I think the board and management hears the perspective of the committee, so they will be able to when they engage in that policy to understand our perspective. I think that helps. We are going to have the second presentation. Can we run through the answers and then Khalebe will give his very serious question, and then we close. Well, otherwise, we have got to move.
Thank you, Chair. Very broadly, I was taking the question of communication, that we are seriously engaging with that, and we are working together with the department as well to spread the word and making sure that we reach the students. There is a project that we are discussing with the Department of Higher Education and Training of Apply Now campaign. So and that campaign is intended to cover quite a lot of high schools. We are also going to be working with the basic with the Department of Basic Education in that regard. But the project is at an early stage at the moment. Regarding why Eastern Cape only, we are engaging with other provinces at the present moment. I have in my diary a meeting with Gauteng sometime next week, if not in 2 weeks' time, and we are going to be approaching various provinces as well. But not only various provinces, we are dealing with the CETAs, but we need to do it in particular small chunks so that we can do it systematically. I'm just looking at, there's a question of the missing middle. It's a difficult one, but as it has been indicated earlier on, it's one of those that also need part of the transformation, but also influence from this committee in that direction, in that policy discussion will also assist. We've got a threshold of 122,000. Anything above that, family contribution, we are not funding. But somebody might say, what's the difference between 122,000 and 123,000? So those are the discussions that are taking place. The chairman of the finance committee did indicate that there are initiatives. We are talking to PIC because most of these students are kids of the public servants, to see how best they can assist in that particular way. But any funding source to deal with this particular category will be welcome even from the private sector or wherever. I think I have covered all the issue of Ndabankulu very briefly. Ndabankulu was a special project, and it was dedicated and designed for Ndabankulu people. As you can see, that I did indicate that it is a rolling fund and it is dissipating and finishing off. It's a special project. Thank you, Chair.
Whatever.
No, Chair. I just wanted to reiterate in terms of the your IT system. That's how is it going to link with the institutions for the purpose of data capturing, so that we'll be able to know and track all your students. Two, what informs your the new model that you're going to implement?
I'm going to start with the what we are doing currently, and the chairperson of the finance committee will also elaborate on that. Currently, we are having a pilot project on 6 universities to electronically and directly capture data, and data be transferred to NSFAS at the present moment. So we've got that pilot project, which is going to assist, and we intend to roll it to all the universities. But we're starting with the pilot project on 6 institutions. Maybe you can come in.
Chairperson, as far as how the link actually works, there's collaboration between the NSFAS IT service providers, people who write the software codes for us, for our system, and ITS, which is the system that the university runs. And so there are technical modifications that are made on both sides so that the data can interface. So the data will be captured on the university side on ITS. That data is then immediately, through a software code, is immediately available on the NSFAS side. The reason why this is so important is that when there is a change made on the university side, so let's say a student has had to go back to get an affidavit, for example, where parents don't have identity documents, so the system on the university side will flag that there's an outstanding item. When that outstanding item comes back, that field is updated, and that application can then go to the next step in the process. The system at the moment is that the application form stays at the university. The loan form stays at the university while the student goes off to get this one piece of missing information, and it could take months, because what the universities do is they batch these forms. So they put the form in a box, and then when the box is full, the box gets sent. It could take months for that particular student. What informs this is that the availability of financial aid to a particular student must be as quick as possible. So that student accessing financial aid or being approved must not be dependent on a box filling up, the box being couriered to NSFAS, and data getting captured twice. So it's really efficiency in making financial aid available that is critical here.
Well, thanks very much. Let's say that you must not, as NSFAS, fear to engage the issue of the missing metal. It's a necessary intervention that is required. You are the experts. You can design a formula that will ensure that those whose parents can pay, then meet them halfway to be able to really access higher education, those who are extremely poor, full funding, and all that, but having increased the band of
does not mean that if you qualify, you are entitled to get anything. You will have to look at various factors, including the successful performance. For instance, if students have been a recipient of NSFAS in the first year and pass all courses, automatically then that is your preferred person, because these are the ones who need really to be funded and exit the system quickly, and that creates a sustainable system of funding. Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Two follow-ups, and I just want that to come clear. The one is on the conversion to graduates. You're saying universities feed you with that information, and immediately you are able to convert. Are you able to cover everybody involved? Have you budgeted enough that there's no need we are able to cover them, or there are challenges, you know, so that we know? The second, just quickly, because we need to get that lot of, in some instances we learn that you argue that depending on the availability of funds and so on, some may not be covered and all of that, so it's important for us to get that clarity. The second, this system, the new model that you're talking about and so on, when is it starting? Because it has been budgeted for now. What's the projection? That question was raised earlier by the prof. And it's not coming clear exactly when is it going to be starting. What message do we communicate now? When do you phase out this system that is being used now, the filling of the boxes and all that, manually couriered or whatever, to this IT system where immediately you are able to engage with that? When do you intend ensuring that you break with the past? The very last check, for interest, perhaps I can get even from you or somebody, page 8 of the annual, the strategic plan, 4.4, I'm interested in understanding what is the implication to NSFAS. I'm trying to understand it. Some clear, straightforward, but I think I may be missing something there.
Meaning whether they respect this rule. This is a rule that has been in existence. It must be respected. Are you now able to respect this rule in terms of accumulation of interest to your debtors?
Okay. Chairperson, I'll take the question about the in-duplum rule first. Part of the credit refund project specifically related to this, NSFAS is now in a position to send out statements to debtors with the correct balances. Interest has been recalculated, and that process is ongoing. So we had a representatives of the compliance unit of the National Credit Regulator were at the Finance Committee meeting on Friday last week. We are in the process of finalizing the documentation to the National Credit Regulator that the in-duplum rule is no longer a problem. In relation to the question about the final year program, all final year students who were eligible and applied for the final year program have been granted the loans. So the 851 million rand that is reported has been made available to those students as loans, final year loans. The process now is that each university submits a final report. And that final report includes information about individual students, so indicating if you were a first-year student, how many courses were you registered for, how many did you pass. If you were a final-year student, do you qualify to graduate? There is a final report process that happens where those final reports are uploaded from the university side onto the NSFAS loan management system, and the bursary conversion is done. So what will happen is that if a student has been granted a loan of, let's say, 10,000 Rand for their final year, it currently sits on the system as a loan. The money is there. It is fully funded. If the student qualifies to graduate, the conversion will happen and that 10,000 rand is converted to a bursary, the student therefore has no debt in that regard. But it's not a question of NSFAS now having to go and find the money for it. The 851 million, it's there, it's committed, it's been paid out to the universities. The target date for full implementation is 2014 academic year.
Okay. Let's thank you for your presentation. We hope that you'll continue really becoming visible where the people are, including a strategy of engaging with our 7,000 public high schools so that those that qualify to be university students, to be college students, are able to access support from yourselves. You are excused. Can we then give chance to the Council on Higher Education? I was just being advanced. There has been an apology that you received from the chairperson of the council, because we're going to be dealing with the annual performance plan. I think these are the relevant people to give us the detail that we require for the purposes of checking whether they are doing things right. Then I'm going to permit the chief executive officer to proceed with the presentation.
Mark Hayes, the Executive Director for Quality Assurance, and I'm the CEO. I'll do the overall presentation and my colleagues will respond to questions related to their portfolios, depending on the type of questions that we address. What we have prepared is a fairly brief presentation on the assumption that members have had the opportunity to look at the detailed document and to highlight the key issues in terms of the work of the council. I hope I may, in the course of the presentation, also address from a different perspective the BTEC issue, because I think it has other implications that the committee may want to consider. As the NSFAS also pointed out, as you will see, for those members who've been part of this committee previously, the structure of the strategic plan is now different, because there have been new Treasury regulations on how to prepare strategic plans. There are three areas that the strategic plan has a set of strategic imperatives, which are not on the slides that you've received. From there, we derive a set of strategic goals and then a set of objectives. And in the presentation, I'm going to focus on the strategic goals and the objectives that flow, the work objectives that flow from those goals. Members are familiar with the work of the CHC in terms of its functions in relation to the Higher Education Act. And just for purposes of clarity again, there are four functions: advise the minister on any aspect of higher education, to quality assure the higher education system in terms of institutional audits, the accreditation of programs, and promoting quality assurance. And with the change, the National Qualifications Act in 2008, the CHE is now responsible for the qualifications framework for higher education, the HEQF, for the setting of standards, all of which previously, as members are familiar, was the responsibility of the South African Qualifications Authority. And then finally, it's to monitor the state of higher education. Now, before I go to the specific goals and objectives, I'd like to make some general comments linked to the overview in the detailed strategic plan. Again, as members will be familiar, in previous engagements, both in relation to the annual report last year and the earlier and the strategic plan that was presented, we had indicated that the CHE was going through a process of transition, that there have been issues, there have been a period of management instability, particularly at the senior levels, and that there were a whole range of issues that had been, when we reported, I think in August last year on the annual report, we had indicated that both the internal audit, a fairly comprehensive internal audit that was done last year, as well as the external audit that was undertaken by the Auditor General, had identified a whole range of organizational challenges and issues. In some ways, not dissimilar to what the NSFOS was presenting in terms of policies, systems, procedures, and so forth. So that was one set of challenges we had indicated that we were going to work on in a fairly focused manner starting last year. Secondly, we identified, and it's in the document, some of the weaknesses, the two key weaknesses in terms of the mandate of the CHE. The first was in relation to the whole role or the link between quality assurance and planning and funding. So in terms of higher education policy as is currently, the role of the state or government is to steer the system using different tools. The two key tools that the Department of Higher Education and Training uses is the planning, the enrollment planning process that members may be familiar with, where the department engages with institutions on an annual basis to determine what their enrollment numbers and so forth is going to be, what type of programs they offer and are going to do so going forward. And secondly, funding, because those programs and the agreements that are reaching the enrollment planning process are linked to the funding of institutions. The third tool in the policy is quality assurance, and there has been the implementation of a quality assurance framework in the last, the development started 10 years ago, but in a more focused manner in the last 5 or 6 years, but the different tools have not been speaking to each other, and that is that the work that the CHE has been doing in quality assurance, particularly the institutional audits, which is a fairly detailed look at each institution, doesn't feed into the planning and funding processes. Now, as we say, as we've discussed previously, and as we identify in the document, there have been a whole range of reasons, both linked to capacity in the CHE itself, changes in the department, capacity issues, and so forth. I'm just highlighting this because we've identified those as a starting point for developing the strategic plan. So all of those are issues we are currently working on. I think, as I will elaborate, and in the question times we can look at it more carefully, we think we are beginning to turn the corner, but we're not quite out of the woods. I think we've done a lot of the organizational issues, and I think the question was asked of the NSFAS earlier, you have a whole set of policies and are planning to develop new policies, I think they said 113, and then you also have a further budget to train staff. I don't know. We've gone through that process in the last year. We've revised all our HR policies. I forget, all I seem to do is sign policies. So we don't quite have 113 policies. But I think the other point that we're making about training is that it's easy to change policies. It's a bit cumbersome and it takes a while and effort, But putting it on paper is quite easy in one sense, to ensure that the policies are up to date and so forth. Getting people to implement the policies and getting staff who have been used to operating in a particular way, getting them then to understand that things that can't be done, well, if you want business as usual, takes time. And it takes training, and it takes, you have to monitor it quite carefully. So I think that's particularly where we're finding that while we have the policies, we're now having to work a lot harder, although we've had training programs and so forth, in getting people to understand and comply with what they're expected to do. So that very broadly is the context within which we're operating at the moment. So to go more carefully in more detail to the goals, I've summarized the goals. There are four goals that we've identified in the strategic plan, which is to contribute to the transformation of the higher education system through research and analysis, to contribute to the development of qualification standards, that's the HEQF aspect of the work, and standard setting, to promote quality and to conduct quality assurance in higher education, which is relates to all the areas, institutional audits, program accreditation, quality promotion, and so forth, and then finally to ensure that we have a effective administrative system, financial systems in place. And I'm going to look at each of these goals and some of the challenges and what we're planning to do. Goal one, which is the research and analysis goal, again, as members are aware, and I forgot to highlight that in my opening remarks, that's been a big challenge for the CHE, the monitoring of the system, our capacity to do so from a staffing point of view has been problematic in the last few years. It still remains a problem, although we're in the process of appointing a director to lead that area. And in that area, there are two broad sort of objectives we have. The first is in relation to the advice that the CHE provides to the minister, which is at the minister's request, or the CHE can do so proactively. So it's not, CHE can decide based on work that it's done to provide the minister with advice on any matter relating to higher education. And as members are aware, there are certain things, changes in legislation, establishment of new institutions, and so forth, where the minister has to come to the CHE for advice before he proceeds to the necessary changes that he may want. He doesn't have to accept the advice we provide, but he has to ask for that advice and to respond. And previously we had indicated there hadn't been a lot of requests for advice, which was partly because the new department itself was being structured and finding its feet. We have in the last year provided the minister with five pieces of advice. The first was in relation to the National Higher Education Information Application Systems. Secondly, advice on the proposed unbundling of Madunsa from the University of Limpopo. Thirdly, advice on the proposals to establish the two new universities in the Northern Cape and Mpumalanga. Fourthly, advice, which I suppose wasn't really advice, about how the CHE's quality assurance system works. And finally, we've just recently, the council has finalized. It hasn't yet been submitted to the minister. We will be submitting it to him next week. His advice on the desirability of introducing a graduate community service scheme. The minister had asked for advice on looking at something like the Funza Lushaka scheme in teacher education, or the scheme in the health professions, where students have to do a period of community service after their internship. And that advice is in the process. And I'm providing this background information because there was a period in which we were not very active in the advice area because of the nature of the changes that were taking place. The major piece of work that we currently have initiated, and which will go into this next financial year, on which we will be providing advice in a sense proactively, is in relation to the desirability and feasibility of introducing or extending the current undergraduate diploma and degree programs. As you know, at the core, diplomas are three-year diplomas. The general formative degrees are three-year degrees, the BA, BCom, BSCs, and so forth. And then we have professional degrees, which are 4 years in duration. It's been an ongoing debate about whether, given the problems of the transition from school to university, and in particular the poor preparation because of the problems of the school system, whether we should be re-looking at whether the current undergraduate structure is appropriate or whether by extending it one can introduce elements of addressing the particular problems that students who come into the higher education system who may be poorly prepared, and therefore a way of enhancing throughput and graduation rates. We have a task team that the CIC has established, which is chaired by Professor Injabulo Ndebele, and it is anticipated that the task team will provide a report to the CIC in the latter half of this year, and once the council has the opportunity to engage with it, it will provide advice to the minister. It, as you know, it's a big issue. It's been identified in the green paper as a possible way of addressing issues of throughput and graduation rates. Secondly, we have just completed looking at performance indicators. Now, this is part of a monitoring function. It's something we should have been doing for a number of years. Often people in the public sphere, including members of parliament, don't have all of the information easily at hand, basic statistical information of what is going on in higher education. So what we are planning, we've taken the objectives, policy objectives that were set, that are currently in place in the National Plan for Higher Education, and then developed a set of statistical tables showing what has been happening in the system, in this case starting from 2005, which was post the sort of merger process and incorporation process. We will be producing these as fairly easy to read, with not a lot of analysis, initially just a set of tables on a set. I think we've got 6 booklets that we're preparing, which will be in a they're not booklets in a booklet form, they'll be something that people can add on. So if we send you a set of data, you could add annually what the changes have been. So in the sense of what we've called in the presentation at a glance booklets, which will provide fairly easy access to get what's happening in the state of higher education at a general statistical level. Then we're planning from a more general research point of view. There are four areas we're planning. The one is in relation to institutional governance, particularly focused, as the minister indicated yesterday, on those institutions which are either currently under administration or where there are weak governance systems. And the question really is to ask, well, why is it, what can we learn, particularly from the institutional audits that the CAG has done in the last 5 years? Why is it that there's a set of institutions, whatever the historical reasons and in terms of the way they were established, funded, etc., why do we continually have problems of governance? So if you take, to illustrate Walter Sisulu University, Walter Sisulu now has its, I think, third administrator. There were previously, in 2001 or 2002, an administrator was appointed, there'd been an assessor, then there was a further administrator appointed by the then Minister of Education. We're now on to the third administrator at Walter Sisulu. We've had problems at Zululand. There were previously problems at Zululand. We've got an administrator. So it's trying to unpack how do you address what seems to be a perennial problem. It emerges every year in a set of institutions. And leaving aside the particular history, what is it about governance in those institutions that need to be addressed using the information that we have in the institutional audit reports? Secondly, we want to start a project looking, we've done some work in conjunction with private providers, because as you know, again, if you look at the Green Paper on Higher Education, the section, if you want, that's the weakest, or one of the sections that's the weakest, as the paper says, there's just not enough information on what is happening in private, or they talk about private further and higher education. We're going to focus more narrowly on private higher education. What is the type of provision? What kind of programs are being offered? Again, we have a very large and rich database because we accredit all of the programs that private providers offer. The third area one of the junior researchers has started looking at is the whole issue of student governance. And particularly, we've been interested, well, there are two issues, but there may be others as we get into the project. The two issues that we are interested in unpacking is the implications of what some institutions have done in terms of not allowing student political organizations to contest elections, because that may well be unconstitutional in a sense. And secondly, particularly in multi-campus institutions, where there's a complicated SRC structure of a central SRC and campus SRCs, and there's often contestation between the different, between the central structure and the substructures. And then finally, Mark can talk about this. I think we're in the process of starting it. Some work has been done. We're going through all of the institutional audit reports, which, as you know, were completed. The final audits were completed in the middle of last year, to look at what are the key issues, policy issues that emerge from these reports, on which either further research needs to be done or on which we should be considering providing advice. That's the aspect of the work I was talking about, where there's a weakness, that we haven't used the information we have to inform, either to inform the sector of what some of the key issues, the challenges that face the sector, or to advise the minister appropriately on interventions that fall within the authority of the minister. But this is an area, as I said, is a developing area. It's been an area of weakness for the CAG. But we hope that we, with the appointment of a director who will take office some point later this year, we'll now be able to move in a more focused manner in doing this work. If we go to the next area, which is the development of Goal 2, which is the development of qualification standards. As members know, last year we had informed the committee that we were revising the higher education qualifications framework to address a set of problems that had been identified by providers, by both public institutions, private providers, and professional bodies. The minister gazetted the sub-frameworks, as they are called, the higher education, the one for the general and further education, and the one for trades and occupations in December last year. We are waiting the public comments close sometime in March, and we're waiting to see what the outcome of that is before that process is finalized. The two key areas, the two main changes we've made to the qualifications frameworks is the introduction in professional programs for two-year diploma programs. As you know, currently in higher education, the diplomas are three-year diplomas that the universities of technologies offer. But in a range of professional areas, particularly in the health sciences, there's been a demand for two-year diplomas in order to, what are they called, mid-level health workers that the Department of Health would like to sort of train. So the revised HEQF provides for the introduction of two-year diplomas linked to professional qualifications, so not for general purposes. And secondly, the other major change is in relation to postgraduate qualifications for professionals. Currently, in the previous HEQF, the moment you've completed your undergraduate program, in order to do postgraduate programs, particularly master's and doctoral programs, you went through the academic route. You had to do an honors degree, master's degree, and then a PhD. And the purpose of an academic route into postgraduate programs is largely either for research or for training people who are going to work in higher education. But there are many people who want to do postgraduate programs, teachers, school principals, health workers, and so forth, who may want to do masters but are not interested in pursuing academic careers. They want to do it for professional reasons. And previously, the masters were structured where you had to do a substantive research component. So what you would find in many institutions is people would register for the masters, they would do the taught courses, and then drop out without completing the masters because they didn't want to do the dissertation. So this will provide the introduction of a professional route, will enable somebody to do a professional masters. They would still have to do some research, but it will be a research project linked to their work, rather than a substantive academic research in which you have to look at contribution to knowledge and so forth. And similarly, which is a global trend, we're proposing the introduction of a professional doctorate in those areas where it's appropriate. So, but all of that is subject currently to the consultation process, and we are awaiting the outcome of that process. I want to, in that context, just come back to the BTEC issue. Okay. The BTEC, in the context that the discussion was taking place with the NSFAS, the BTEC has previously not been funded through the NSFAS because it's post the basic diploma, post the three-year diploma that students do, and was regarded by the then technicons and the current universities of technologies as a postgraduate qualification, equivalent to an honors degree. So it was the route for somebody who completed a three-year diploma and wanted to do a master's. Traditionally in the university you would do an honors. Technicons introduced the BTEC. As you may also be familiar, so that's why the NSFAS did not fund it, because the NSFAS funds undergraduate qualifications of whatever sort they are. In the HEQF that was promulgated by the minister, then Minister of Education, Minister Pando, in 2008, the BTEC was removed from the qualifications framework. And similarly, in the revised qualifications framework that is currently being considered, the BTEC does not exist as a qualification. It's still being offered, but the proposal is that it should not continue to be offered in future. Now, we can debate that at some other point or in question time, and the reason for its removal was that the argument at the time, certainly in 2008, and we would submit currently, is that the BTEC is not the equivalent of an honors degree. The fact that you have a three-year diploma does not entitle you then to have a one-year which prepares you for a master's qualification, because there are significant differences between a diploma and a degree. So what the HEQF currently proposes is that you would do a three-year diploma, you would then do an advanced diploma, and then a postgraduate diploma before doing a master's, which takes, post the qualification, two additional years in order to do a master's, whereas somebody doing a degree will do an honors degree, will take 1 year. And I'm raising this in the interest of, because it's something I'm sure you will be debating as the sub-frameworks come onto stream, because one of the arguments against what is in the HCQF is that it takes too long to get to a master's, okay, so that it puts an additional burden on students from a financial and time point of view. Our argument is, well, there are no shortcuts from undergraduate to postgraduate qualifications, and a degree is different from a diploma, and so the fact that it takes 2 years and it is not the issue. How you fund people is a separate matter. People should be given the appropriate funding so that they are not disadvantaged because they're taking 2 years. But I'm just highlighting and flagging that, because it was clearly a big issue in the discussion with the NSFAS, and I'm sure it will be an issue when you discuss subsequently the qualification frameworks and so forth. So we are awaiting the revision finally, because that will then set in motion a set of work for us to implement the revised HEQ. As you know, in the meantime, we've indicated last year that we've been moving to, that institutions have been asked to align their programs to the HEQF as it was promulgated in 2008. We indicated that we thought there were some 20,000 programs that needed to be aligned, which means they have to resubmit this to the Higher Education Qualifications Committee, which has to assess and process them and so forth. And there were three types of programs. There were those programs, the majority of programs, where there were minimal changes that institutions would have to make in order to meet the alignment requirements. And we've now received, I think it's 15,000, no, 10,000 or 12,000, which we have processed in the last few months. And the HEQC, the Qualifications Committee, will be formally considering them and approving them at its June meeting. So by the middle of this year, we would have processed what were known as the Category A programs, where there was minimal changes that institutions needed to make. We indicated it was going to be a 3 or 4 year process. The next step would be those programs in which between 25 to 30% of the program has to be changed in order to meet the requirements of the HEQF. And we will be starting that later this year and taking it into 2013. And then finally in 2013, 2014, looking at completely new programs. Those, like the BTEC, for argument's sake, if the BTEC is removed, institutions are going to then have to develop new advanced diplomas and postgraduate diplomas to replace the BTEC, and those are completely new programs that they would have to develop, and we will look at that in 2013, 2014. So we are fairly well on track in terms of the HEQF alignment progress. In terms of standard setting, we had in November last year released a discussion document which went out to the higher education sector about how we saw the standard setting process working. We've received comments. The council will be considering a final framework, and then we intend piloting a set of standards development looking at a few qualification types. So we may take a BSc, a BA, a BCom, bring people, the appropriate experts together to say what would the appropriate standards for such a qualification be. But that's the intention, to pilot it starting later this year. Then finally, in relation to private providers, as members know, we currently have what is known as HEQIS, which is the Higher Education Quality Committee Information System. For public higher education institutions, there's a Higher Education Management Information System that is run by the Department of Higher Education and Training. And all institutions have to provide all public institutions have to provide very comprehensive information to the HEMA system. And in part, that system is used for the funding of public higher education institutions. There is no comparable system for private institutions. The system that the CHE had originally developed was in order to meet the regulatory requirement that SACWA requires. SACWA has what is called the National Learner Records Database. And everybody who goes through the education system, as you know, their information has to be inputted into the NLRD. So the CHE had introduced the HEQIS system in order to meet the requirements of SACWA. But the HEQIS doesn't give us the kind of information in order to be able to make, if you want, comparative analysis between what happens in a private institution as against a public institution. So we don't collect information that's comparable. So we are jointly with the department, with the DHET, and the private providers currently looking at how do we revise this HEQIS system so we can create something that's similar to, it won't be exactly the same, but similar to the kind of information that's collected for public higher education institutions. Of course, for the public, there's all sorts of information collected for funding purposes, which obviously we're not going to do in the case of private providers. Similarly, in the case of private providers, many of them are small, and don't have the same kind of IT systems that the big publics have. So we would have to look at what kind of instrument to use to collect that information. We've had the first meeting, joint meeting with the department and the private providers. We are coordinating the process from the CHE side, and we hope that we will have an approved framework jointly with the department and the providers in the course of this year, and then we will look at how best to implement that framework. The other objective, the next, and I think this is a key change that we're introducing, is in relation to quality assurance and the conducting of quality assurance. As you know, we had a cycle of institutional audits which began in 2004-05 and which was completed in 2011. And that cycle focused on quality assurance systems in institutions, looked at their policies and the procedures, and teaching and learning and research and community engagement and so forth. We've had very comprehensive reports. That, again, one of the weaknesses I had identified earlier about how we use that information. For the next cycle, as we've indicated previously, and in fact we talk about it in the strategic plan, we were going to narrow the focus to teaching and learning specifically. And particularly in the light of the problems of teaching and learning, the problems of throughputs, graduation rates, and so forth. However, we're still keeping the focus, but we are rethinking how we do this, and that's not in the strategic plan currently. Because what we had identified in the strategic plan was pretty much the same kind of five-year cycle in which we visit each institution. As you know, with the audit, each institution prepares a fairly detailed institutional reflection on the issue that's at hand. We then go and visit the institution with a panel of experts. A report is then prepared, and there's engagement between us and the institution. And there's a long, drawn-out process because it takes the institution, I think, anything up to 7 or 8 months to prepare its institutional reflection. We then have an audit panel that goes for a week, interviews a whole lot of people, prepares a report. It often takes, because of capacity problems in the CHC previously, it often took 3 or 4 months before the audit report was finalized. We then have a process of engagement with the institution. And quite frankly, sometimes, I'm sort of partly exaggerating, by the time the report comes out, things have changed in the institution. And we wait 5 years before we start moving to the next cycle. So what we are proposing, and it's in the very early stages, it's not been formally approved, it's not even been discussed by the council yet. It's been discussed, an initial discussion at the Higher Education Quality Committee, is that we need to rethink what the role of audits are and how can we ensure that we have greater impacts using the audit process. And in two senses. In the one sense, if we go and talk about teaching and learning to a set of institutions that are currently under administration, what are they going to tell us? They've got such major deep-seated governance problems that there's very little focus that they're able to, in terms of reflecting on, not that they can't do it, but if you take, and I can say this, Walter Sisulu University, which is under administration, the administrator has come and said to us, well, you know, we've had the audit report last year. We now expected to respond to the audit report, but we are not in a position to respond to the audit report because we're dealing with such basic problems, so we need more time to respond to the audit reports. And what we think we need to do is for those institutions working jointly with the department is to find mechanisms with how you build capacity in quality to help them address the problems rather than expecting them to report again, having gone through one cycle, without really addressing the core problems that they face. In the case of the other institutions, more generally, instead of having a 5-year process, what we're thinking about, which is how we do this teaching and learning process, what we say rethinking the methodology, is maybe to identify a set of themes in teaching and learning. So for argument's sake, let's take assessment in higher education as a possible theme. Is each year to have a theme, to have 4 or 5 themes over a 5-year period, in which instead of getting each institution to develop a very long institutional report, we group institutions, maybe regionally, or like type of institutions, let's say the UOTs or research institutions, whatever the case may be, and where they come jointly to present and engage with each other in conjunction with an expert panel about what are the key issues in assessment, which is the example that I use, what may be best practice in assessment, so that within a short period of time, we are able to bring out that in assessment, this is what we think best practice may be, this is what we think institutions should be considering introducing, and in cases where that can be linked to the planning and funding system, this is where we think if there's a need to advise the minister and where the minister has some authority from a policy point of view, because he doesn't have authority in all matters, that he may want to then introduce as linked to his funding and policies, particular changes. So it's a different type of process we're thinking. It's in a very early stages, so I'm raising this tentatively at this stage because we haven't engaged with the institutions on this matter and we haven't internally finalized it. But we think if the system, quality assurance system, is going to have impact, a real impact on what institutions do, then we have to change the way we've been doing quality assurance in the last. Not to say what was done previously was not appropriate. It was appropriate for the time, but we need to rethink how we do it. And as part, you know, the audits that have been completed take 2 or 3 years before it's formally closed off because institutions develop improvement plans, progress reports, and so forth. So that work continues to happen while all of this is going on. In program accreditation, in one sense, there's not a whole lot of new things to report on. As you know, we're responsible for accrediting all programs, new programs that institutions offer, both public and private. And it's a condition for private institutions of their registration that their programs must be accredited by us. The number of programs that we've been accrediting have been increasing. Previously, it's been in about 100, maximum 200. In this last financial year, we've accredited 500 programs. So it's increasing the burden on, and we're looking at how we improve our systems in order to do so. We also have to re-accredit the programs for those institutions, the private providers whose registration is coming to an end, and before they get re-registered by the department, their programs have to be re-accredited by the CAG. And as part of the process, we're looking, sorry, there's a spelling error in there, we're looking at revising the current criteria that we use in order to fine-tune it better based on the lessons we've learned in the last few years. Then finally, in this area of work, we have reinstituted the national reviews. You know, previously, members may be aware, it was very contentious at the time. There was a national review done of the MBA program, which resulted in a number of programs being closed down, which did not meet the criteria. There was a national review done of teacher education programs, where a number of institutions were put on conditional accreditation in order to improve their teacher education programs. For the past few years, this area of work, which we think has the most impact on quality, improving quality in higher education, had been held in abeyance both because of staffing and capacity problems and budgetary problems in the CAG. And as part of the restructuring, the council has reinstituted what we call the National Reviews Directorate. We're in the planning phases at the moment. The first national review which we're going to do, which we had hoped to have started now, but which will start early in the new year, is in social work. The reason we're not starting it now is because the professional council itself is doing work with institutions, so we didn't want the two things to overlap. We've discussed the issue with the professional council, we've talked to the institutions concerned, as well as the Department of Social Development, and there's broad agreement that there will be merit in looking at social work, and we're planning to do that starting in early 2013. We're doing the planning work at the moment. And the second one, which we haven't finalized, we're meeting the Deans of Law next week. We would like to do a national review of the LLB qualification. As members know, previously we've reported that there was a survey done of the LLB, which was done jointly by the CHE and the Deans of Law. I think I've indicated to you that when I came into the CHE, I had not allowed the release of that report because it was poor quality and the methodology was not appropriate. And we think there's scope because of the problems that that report identified in the way that different institutions approach the LLB. We want to do a national review of the LLB. We are talking to the Deans of Law, we'll be talking to the Department of Justice and so forth, and if there's agreement on that, we don't have to get agreement. We have the authority to do it, but the approach is to get buy-in so that everybody works jointly on the project. That will then, we'll start doing the planning work in 2013, and the actual review will take place in 2014. And then finally, what we are doing immediately, which is not quite a national review, because a national review is the only area where the CHE has real authority, because we can close a program down if we decide it's not meeting standards. We have been approached by the South African Institute of Physics, which is a professional association of physicists, particularly the heads of physics departments in the country, who are concerned about challenges in the teaching of physics. Challenges because not many people do it, and other kinds of challenges that they think may need to be addressed. So we've agreed, and we're going to be starting a review of physics. It's not a national review. It's not a review of a qualification. It won't lead to the approval, accreditation, or de-accreditation of a qualification. But we think it may be an important pilot, which if it works, we could do for other areas, to see what are the challenges in the case of physics teaching at an undergraduate level at in higher education. You know, a lot of physics teaching is not for a main qualification because it's often in support of other qualifications. So that process, we're quite far down the track. We're going to be meeting, I think it's going to start in June or July, and should be completed towards the latter half of the year. In quality promotion, Chair, we continue to annually to get together with the Higher Education Teaching and Learning Association, HELTESA, offer awards, which is to promote quality of teaching in higher education institutions. One of the things we've identified jointly with HELTESA is that the institutions, if you want, or the academics that are getting the awards in the last 2 or 3 years since the awards have been placed, have largely come from the institute, not largely, I think only come, Mark can correct me on that, from those institutions that are well-resourced and well-established. So we have run a workshop early this year with institutional managers from the historically disadvantaged institutions and the UOTs to look at how best they can structure their own teaching and learning activities so that they can benefit from participating. They participate in the process, but because of weaker systems that they have, they've not been able to produce people who've been identified for getting awards. We continue to run training programs. Well, we haven't run it for institutional auditors because we will now wait for the next cycle of audits to start, but we continue to run programs for those people who evaluate the programs that we accredit. The most recent training program we had, the department has introduced a new framework for teacher education qualifications, and we've run 2 workshops recently for the people who would be evaluating teacher education qualifications that are submitted for accreditation. We continue to and will continue to host workshops on best practice. Most recently, we've had one on work-integrated learning, which has also resulted in a publication that was released last year, which is particularly targeted at the universities of technology, where a lot of work-integrated learning happens. We've also established or re-established, because it hasn't happened for a number of years, what we call quality forums, to which we invite the quality managers from the private and the public institutions, as well as professional bodies, to engage with what are the issues and what they need to be familiar with. In the case of professional bodies, I should indicate, because it was an issue that came up in the minister's budget speech yesterday, the minister had a set of concerns which are different from what we are addressing, but they are linked. Because there's a big issue because we accredit higher education programs, but so do professional bodies. We accredit from an academic perspective, they do it from the point of view in order to practice as a doctor or a lawyer or whatever it is, or an accountant, you have to meet certain requirements, which is partly what the minister was talking about. But there has always been a tension between institutions, higher education institutions, from an academic perspective about what they think should go into a curriculum and what a professional body thinks should be in the curriculum. And institutions would argue that it's an infringement of academic autonomy because they keep being told by professional bodies you must do A, B, and C, otherwise your students would not be accredited. So we facilitated a discussion where 2 of the deputy vice chancellors came and presented from the institutional perspective what they thought the concerns and problems were. I think it will be an ongoing discussion and engagement because it's a difficult area. We're certainly not suggesting professional bodies don't have a role to play. At the same time, their role is different from what constitutes an academic curriculum for the different professional areas. And there's a healthy tension, but there's also a danger that sometimes what is appropriate from an academic training point of view gets squeezed out of the curriculum because the professional body is increasing its requirements. And I'm sure that is something that's going to be on the agenda and will come up as part of the broader discussion about the role of professional bodies. Of course, the other problem with professional bodies is that they each fall under different legal requirements. So the health professions falls under the Department of Health, the engineering falls under, I think it's Public Works, and so forth, which also creates a problem of coordinating, which I think is partly also what the minister is trying to address as part of his process. Chair, finally, in relation, I have referred to this in relation to the challenges that we faced. As I said, we are addressing, we've gone a long way to revising our policies, our systems and procedures. We know we're near, we think we've turned the corner, we're certainly not out of the woods. The big problem we face at the moment, and it's becoming increasingly so, is recruitment and retention of senior senior staff in the CAG. And the problem we are having is that our salary structure is linked to the public service, which we think is appropriate, but we are no longer able to compete with higher education institutions. When the CAG was first established, in fact, it was a very attractive place for academics to come and work because the salaries were better at the CAG in the public service than they were in higher education institutes. And I'm not talking about academics, if you want, who are teaching and researching. I'm talking particularly those people who move out of the academic track and go into the sort of university administration track or management track, where a lot of the quality assurance people and so forth would sit. So we are increasingly finding that we are not able to match the outer, in the case of directors in the public service, which is a scale we use, the outer range of the scale, I think it's about 850,000 rand now. The equivalent, not in all institutions, but in many institutions, is over a million rand. So in trying to attract the appropriately skilled and experienced and qualified people, we are not able to offer the salaries. There are other perks that institutions have. If your kids are in the institution, you get a fee remission. We have 20 days leave. Institutions have, I don't know, 40 days leave. There are all sorts of other perks that academics have. So we are reviewing our current salary structure and developing, Vuyo is leading that at the moment. We want to see whether we can introduce some flexibility. We're keeping our current range, but where we can, within that maybe 10 or 20%, depending on the individual we want to attract, that we are able to make slightly better offers than we're currently able to do. We are close to finalizing, I think this has to be signed off, the employment equity strategy, and we didn't previously have a staff training and development program, and that has been instituted since last year. So that's ongoing at the moment. As I've indicated, we have looked at all of our policies, and we're hoping that within the next year we should be compliant with everything that we need to be compliant with. Finally, Chair, I haven't got the detailed budget is in your document. We had previously indicated there had been a cut in our budget of 10% or so. In the strategic plan, we do identify areas where we may be concerned about. The one is standard setting, where there was a one-off allocation, and which will run out. But because the work has taken been delayed, it may not run out by 2014, 2015, but eventually we may need some additional resources. What's not reflected in this budget is the minister or the treasury has made an additional allocation for conditions of service, because each year we've been budgeting based on treasury inputs on a salary increase in the public of about 6%. But as you know, for the last 2 years, salary increases have been for middle level staff and below 10% per annum. So it's not something that we've been budgeting for. So I think as a result of that, there's been an additional allocation made in order to take into account the fact that our budgets may be impacted on by the salary increases. We do collect income from private providers for the service that we provide for accreditation. As you can see, this is going up. Up to last year, we were not basing it on cost recovery. So this year we've introduced a new scheme where we've more carefully worked out what it costs us to take through the process of crediting a program of private provider, and we're now charging what we think are appropriate, at least cost recovery fees. They may not be completely market-related fees, but at least we're covering the costs of the staff in the processes that we... The interest income is reducing, because the only interest we get at the moment are the funds that were allocated for standard setting, because it was a once-off allocated which we were able to invest. But as those funds get depleted, we will not have, because we currently don't have any reserves to speak of. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments?
Let me take you back to NSWAS and the PTAC. If I got you well, the technicons are recognizing BTEC as a postgraduate, like honors. CHE doesn't. And it is proposing advanced something, something. I'm not sure what is the status of that BTEC as we stand. Who decides what is what? Because I accept and appreciate if it is regarded as a postgraduate. NSFAS doesn't fund postgraduate. But I have two structures here. One says yes, one says no. If you are going to say further, therefore you need, are you therefore, can I take it as CHE recognizes a diploma as in the same status as a degree? The second question, it again, it's a policy question, as you advise the minister. It arises again from NSFAS. NSFAS tells us that the disabled students need more funding because of the gadgets. But as we speak, there is no policy allowing them to do that. I'm not sure now who triggers that policy, because sitting where I'm seated, I'm feeling uncomfortable to say I'm putting money aside for disabled, but our policy doesn't allow them as disabled to get the necessary funding. Thank you.
Chair, I just want to check in terms of the review of the physical sciences. What is the alignment in terms of your strategy with the basic education? If I can just get you. And the issue of the retention strategy, you know, we were engaging with some other professors last week who made a sort of a comment to say, you know, sometimes becomes a challenge that as a professor, his salary is at a low level, but is producing an educationist that will earn double his salary. I'm trying to check, because my question there was to say, what kind of education are we instilling into our learners or into our students? Because once we instill an educational mindset to say money is better than the knowledge and the productivity that we must have as South African, therefore we're losing it. That's why if you can just take and assess the current youth as we speak today, some of them, they don't want to go to school. They prefer to go and queue for tenders, because they think it's the best thing, you know, to achieve. Why? It's because the education that we instill in our mindset is that money is important than the positive contribution that you can make into our communities. If you can, I'm trying to check what is the strategic aspect of the CHE in putting a positive mindset into our community. I'll come for the next sentence, Chair.
Chair, thank you. Mine will be short. I think on the point, one of the goals is to advise the Minister on higher education expansion. I would like to maybe just get some more information on the advice around and the feasibility around the extra universities, the two universities that is in the planning stage. Was there any feasibility studies done on various aspects, on the availability of educators, on availability and the position of the
of the size of the universities as well, maybe on the independence, are there an indication if they are maybe going to be collaborating with some of the existing institutions? Like, for instance, let me just give you my way of thinking. In Nelspruit, there is a Lowveld Agricultural College with huge potential of expansion and facilities available. Was that taken in consideration? And maybe just give us more info on that. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Also, just briefly, first of all, I would just like to emphasize the important work that the CHE is doing, and I think the quality assurance of our higher education system is extremely important. And I can perhaps say that I don't know whether it was a privilege or not, but I had gone through one of those quality assurance sessions and interviews when I was at a university, and it's very thorough. I am, however, extremely concerned about capacity constraints. Could you perhaps give us an indication in terms of staff, percentage-wise, where the shortfall is? Thank you.
Quickly. Mine is on relation to standards. Part of your responsibility is to monitor that the standards of institutions and also in relation to qualifications. The problem we always find is that some institutions, for instance, IT, if you do IT in one institution, like let's use Walter Sisulu, I like using Walter Sisulu. From Walter Sisulu, you want to go to VETS or UCT, you'll be expected before admission, if you pass your qualification, you want to proceed with another, to be conducted maybe through an assessment test by university. To me, that has always sent an impression as if qualification from another university is better than the other. Then they want to assess you. How do you monitor that particular aspect, that qualification of institutions are treated at the same level? Because if you are, if I'm correct, in an institution that is supposed also to look to accreditation, therefore you're supposed to be at least having a standard qualification accreditation. Higher education transformation. Institutions have super visions and missions. Nice, want to be a first choice, world-class technological university, want to be a transformative university, want to be a developmental university. Part of your work, do you monitor that institutions, as they project themselves out there to communities, they maintain or implement their identified objective, or they live according to the promise they want to give? Because many of the universities, they project themselves as good universities who not necessarily live with their objective. Is that your role to monitor to what extent that university is consistent with their vision and mission? Lastly, the student movement. The student movement. This is becoming a problem. And I like that you have raised this issue in South Africa in general. And the role of vice chancellors, some vice chancellors in that respect. It is a one-party dominated environment. And who is supposed to act to institutions that are not complying with the law, where all other organizations are not accommodated or accepted in these institutions, imposed by a party that is in student governance at a particular time, because it does not promote student activism if a one party suppresses the other, if COPE takes over to today, like in Walter Sisulu again, this is happening in Walter Sisulu, where there was chaos around student governments. It happened in Fort Hare. Therefore, can you tell us who as parties can we report to when we're denied an opportunity to participate in student governance.
I think let me allow Khadebe. You wanted a second, but oh, you are happy now. So yeah.
So I'm not sure of that arrangement, but
literally about to march to the chair. Yeah, you remember initially he spoke at last.
Okay. I've got two issues. Well, I may go to the third because I heard his mamas. So, but my first would relate to the national reviews. And I have actually realized that we have now once more re-established the directorate to assist in that regard. But you're lamenting that the funds that are available may necessarily just be for the staff and not necessarily for the operational engagements. And apparently you have done three reviews by now, but when I go deep into your documents, you at what one point one field you want to do about 17 of the national reviews. And you may need to expand that for a longer period, or you're talking about even 5 year period. For teacher development or some qualifications you wanted to do about 5 and so on and so on. Given the capacity constraint, it does mean that it will take so much time unless you are able to have other creative methods to raise the funds. Because the issue I'm raising will be in page 38, but there's a larger body where you're explaining the issue of those particular reviews, which is it's a serious problem. I think you're seeing where I'm referring to. Yeah, that's 38 and 39. You're talking to this issue of the national reviews. And I'm sorry, I may not be able quickly to take you to the part where you are explaining this on the other pages, but I can help in that regard later on. But I'm talking to the creative manner or mechanisms of you running this national reviews in a much shorter period. It takes you about 8 months or so for now to do one, and very costly, about 2 million rands and so on. And if that amount is not available, or those funds are not available, obviously we're sitting with a problem because we need delivery from you quickly. I'm checking whether it's not easy for you to engage the private sector to be able to raise some of this funding and be able to run them quickly. The second issue, I'm interested in the 795,000 material issue that dealt with your audit, financial audit. That will be on page 43. Perhaps you can talk to what was involved there, what actually happened, the issue of irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. Yes. The last would relate, Chair, to what I used to raise about RPL, the RPL recognition of prior learning. I would be interested in your take in that particular regard. Or the issue of the national reviews is from page 26 to 27. I think you see you're going at length there, but there are constraints. So I'm saying in terms of RPL, there's frustration generally, and institutions of higher learning have got their own attitude in that regard. But generally, it's done at piecemeal, not coordinated. There have been conferences in that regard, but there's not much movement. What is it that your own institution will be doing in that regard? Thanks.
answer the questions that around staffing capacity and some of the issues on national reviews that my colleagues will take. If I can start with Prof. Maya Tula's first issue, the status of the VA, the status of the, not the VA, sorry, the BTEC. The BTEC, and I don't want to now speak on behalf of the department, they can speak for themselves, but the BTEC, from a funding point of view, from a departmental, from the funding framework point of view, and I can speak with it because I was involved in the department at the time, is funded separately from the national diploma. So it's funded by the department as a one-year qualification, which is a postgraduate qualification. So it's, or it's, let's call it a second qualification rather than a postgraduate qualification. And that's how it's always been done. There were some institutions historically who were registering students automatically for BTEC degrees. This was in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then claiming a subsidy that all our students are BTEC students. And at that time, the department said, well, that's not how this works. In terms of the way the formula is structured and the programs are structured, you have to register people for a national diploma first, and then those who want to continue will continue and do a BTEC. Not everybody automatically does a BTEC. So institutions were, I better be careful what I say, were sometimes using the system in order to generate a larger slice of the subsidy for themselves. So the BTEC is always, from a policy point of view, been regarded as a subsequent qualification. And that's why the NSFAS did not fund it. In terms of the qualifications framework, in 2008, for the reasons I had suggested about whether the BTEC, what the role of the BTEC was, the then minister, when she promulgated the HCQF, had removed the BTEC as a it's still offered currently. And the reason it's still offered is because in terms, when the HCQF was promulgated in 2008, there was a clause which said that the minister will decide when the formal implementation of the HCQF will begin, at a date to be implemented. And that hasn't been determined by the minister yet. And I expect will be determined after this revised HCQF is done. So in that sense, the BTEC continues to be offered by what are the universities of technology now. I hope that answers the question, Prof. The revised HCQF similarly, so the advanced diploma that the, which is in the HCQF will be post a qualification post the diploma. So it will raise the question again, do qualifications that happen after the undergraduate level, should they be funded by the NSFAS? That's a policy issue that should be then addressed as part of an NSFAS issue. In the case of disability, as I understand it, and for my sins, for a short period I was an acting CEO of the NSFAS. I think, I mean, I don't want to speak because the NSFAS people are not here. There was an issue then when we were looking at the budgets, because whatever had been allocated at that point, I'm talking about 2 years ago, for disability was not being utilized completely, firstly. Now, I think it probably has to do with whether it's adequately communicated. There are also problems that there are certain areas of disability, the more serious areas, where an individual institution can't address it. And we haven't found mechanisms about how this can be done, maybe at a regional level or so forth. I think in terms of the policy, what the colleagues were referring to is that in providing support to NSFAS students, disabled students, you have to provide additional, so they may require particular equipment. I suppose if it's a student who is blind will require access to Braille reading or particular types of computers. And, so forth. And that's a policy decision that NSFAS itself can make. Because NSFAS would have to get the minister's approval, but NSFAS will be making, should be making a recommendation to the minister that for that this is the framework we use. We want to change the framework in order to increase the amount we give to an individual student, or for the different kinds, because it's complicated in disability, because the different kinds of disability. There's nothing precluding, as far as I understand, the NSFAS from doing so. If the board, NSFAS board, would have to develop a policy, approve it, get the minister's approval, the department sits on the NSFAS board. So there shouldn't be a problem. So I think it should be addressed. It's not something that the minister needs to do. as far as I'm aware. In terms of the issue of the retention strategy, not in relation to the CIT, but more generally in higher education, you know, as members would know, and at the minister, I think, again, raised in his budget speech yesterday, and it's in the green paper, we face a major challenge in terms of reproducing the next generation of academics and researchers. And quite frankly, there are two problems, I think, in my view. One is that the bursaries or scholarships that we offer for postgraduate qualifications is much too low. So if you, the National Research Foundation is the main provider of postgraduate scholarships. If you do a PhD, you get 100,000 rand per annum for, I think, 3 years or so, whatever it is. If you're doing a master's, it's 80,000 rand per annum. If it's in particular scarce skill areas, it's a little more. Okay. So if you think about it, somebody who, and then the salaries, and the salaries I was talking about are people who moved out of the academic stream and have gone into the administrative management scheme. So a lot of senior professors at universities currently may, it varies from institution to institution, but a lot of senior professors may be earning between, depending on the institution and their level and experience, something between 500,000 and maximum 800,000. And the maximum will be in very few institutions. So on average, it's about 600,000, let us say. To produce an academic takes, if they work, if they start from university, from as an undergraduate to completing a PhD, takes about 10 years. Okay. So if you think about it, what you're saying to somebody who has spent 10 years getting, and then when they enter the labor market, they'll enter as a junior academic, then they're going to be earning, I don't know, 200,000 rand, 300,000 rand, if that. An entry level in the public service, an entry level post for a senior administrative officer. Now, I'm not talking about deputy directors and directors and so forth. A senior administrative officer who has a 3-year diploma, maybe some experience, they start with 185,000 rand a year. So if you're getting 100,000 rand as a PhD student, what is the attraction for keeping you in the academic world, given that most of these, particularly in the case of African students, they'll be first generation postgraduate students. They've got family pressures and so forth. Okay, when we have, so a lot of the postgraduate students, the majority of the, not the, I think the majority, I don't have the figures now, of postgraduate students, particularly PhD students, are people coming from other parts of the continent, where there's an established, if you want, middle class. Okay, so we have an established non-African middle class in this country. So those people do it because they have access to family resources and they don't feel the same family pressures. Again, if you take most of the people who are doing, the average age of a PhD graduate is 40 in the humanities and 35 in the sciences, which means people are, most of the people doing postgraduate study are doing it part-time. There are very few people who are doing it as a normal trajectory, you know, undergraduate degree, master's, PhD. Most of them would tend to be white and non-African because they've got access to their family resources, but there's also a family tradition of people have gone into the academic world. So we do face a problem about how we compensate. And then if you go and work in the university, well, you can go and work as a director in the public service with a 3-year degree, and the entry level is 710,000 rand. Okay? That's more than what a professor earns having done 10 years of study, whatever they do. So I think the point you're making is important. I'm not in a position to talk about whether the educational system, the values, that the, if you want, the material values, the values that the education system is promoting. I suspect it's more what's happening in the society more generally, in the way we compensate, who we compensate, and what role that plays. I think there's a broader issue which is outside of the education system that needs to be addressed. I'm not directly asked because it's not something that we deal with in a narrow sense. So I think there is a bigger problem. I don't think we have a crisis in terms of the next generation, but we do have a problem. And that problem needs to be, the minister is saying in his budget speech in the green paper, but a lot of it is about how we compensate people for what they do, and we're not doing that adequately for people in the academic world. In terms of the advice, the reports, the minister had established two task teams, one for the Northern Cape and one for Mpumalanga, and they did fairly detailed studies. I'm not sure if they're public. I presume the committee could request those studies, but there were feasibility studies done which looked at population dynamics, number of students in the school system, what the potential. I'm reluctant to say what our advice has been because it's not been made public, and I don't want to make it public, but I'm happy to share the provide members of the committee with the advice we provided. I think the report, I can say this, the report did look at all of the different infrastructure, particularly in Mpumalanga, because there's infrastructure that was built by what is the Tshwane University of Tetela. They have a dedicated campus. The Lowveld Agricultural College is nearby. There's a nursing college not so far away. Well, in the Bela College that the minister talked about is a little further out of the region. But as I understand the proposal, was to indicate that there's sufficient infrastructure in Mpumalanga. It may require some additional administrative offices and so forth in order to manage. But it was looking at all the existing infrastructure, including the colleges. And I can certainly say from the side of the council, not in relation to the new universities, but in relation to the response to the Green Paper, that we are saying that the issue of the nursing colleges and agricultural colleges, which has been an ongoing issue since 1994 about where they should be located, under whose jurisdiction, our view is that we should bring some finality and put them under the DHET. And they can then have the appropriate arrangements with health and agriculture to make sure that their needs are being met. But the current fracturing of the system is not helping. And those colleges that can then be used as part of both school system along the lines that the minister was suggesting. Currently, those institutions do collaborate. There was a question, what is the North, the Mpumalanga Institute of Higher Education? Is that what they call currently? National Institute, sorry. Each institution, they don't offer their own qualification. So TUT, Tshwane University, offers some of the qualifications, and there may be other institutions. I think Wits of Pretoria used to offer the teacher education qualification and so forth. Similarly in the Northern Cape. So they are in the Northern Cape, I think it's a Free State, University of Free State. Western Cape was involved. I forget the details, but there are different, currently it's based on collaboration or those institutions offering those programs. And then finally, Chair, if I can, before they hand over to, our audit process looks at things like vision and mission. The problem that I'd identified before is that we needed to make sure that the annual decisions about and monitoring and on annual basis happens through the department's enrollment planning process. And so the department monitors based on what the ministers agree from a funding point of view. And we need to create greater synergy between ourselves and the department in terms of what we found and the information we have. And that's been a weakness. So I think that needs to be addressed, what you're saying. It's not been adequately addressed because there have been challenges on both sides. In the case of the student institutions have institutional statutes which define governance, institutional governance. So in the institutional statute, there will be provision made for the SRC model, SRC elections, and so forth. The statutes get approved by the minister formally. But if there's a problem of the sort that you identify, that's an institutional issue. That means the institution is not doing, or the way in which institutional governance is operating is a problem. And so at the first step, it should be taken up with the institution itself. Obviously, if it's a bigger issue, it may require intervention at the level of the department. So the institution has the authority. Finally, in relation to materiality, what this is referring to is we are expected to indicate to the Treasury what is the scope, where would we regard something. If something gets stolen that's under 2,000 rand, it may not be regarded formally. So that's the materiality framework that this is referring to, if that was the question. And it's based on an assessment of the risk, what kind of budgets we have, and what we think is an appropriate materiality framework. So this is not referring to any particular, act of fraud or corruption, etc. In terms of RPL, I think the point you make is important. There's nothing stopping any institution from using RPL in a regulatory sense. If you look at the higher education qualifications framework, it talks about RPL. Institutions have something known as Senate discretion. So an institution, the example the minister was giving at dinner last night of Hotstix Mabuza, who wants to study. Now there's nothing stopping any institution from taking him on. They may want to do some diagnostic assessments to see at what level he can study, but he doesn't have to do a matric. And the only people in terms of the current matriculation regulations is if you're under 23, you have to meet certain. Once you're above 23, or particularly if you're above, I think it's 35, I forget now, there are no regulations that apply. And for somebody who wants to do an honors degree, they don't even need an undergraduate degree if they're over a certain age. So the problem lies not in the regulations, but in the in institutions. And RPL is complicated. It's a costly exercise. If they have to assess, you know, if Vuyo came and said she wanted to do something and she needs to be assessed as an individual and her portfolio, so then institutions often don't have that capacity. So I think the issue is really how do we ensure that we build and where should that happen? So the minister talked, he established a task team or a committee, a reference group. SACWA is doing a whole lot of research. We will be collaborating with SACWA to see what are the obstacles and what solutions one can find. So it's not a sort of legal obstacle. The obstacle is in the practice rather than in the... And finally, Chair, before I hand over, the budget problem for national reviews that we identified will be less of a problem because we have got, because we've not filled all of our posts, etc. We expect, we haven't done our final annual income expenditure statement. We do anticipate there will be savings there, which we will then, if it's rolled over, we will then utilize to do the national reviews. We're not talking of large number of national reviews, but I'll ask Mark to address that specifically, and then Vuyo can talk about the issue of capacity constraints in the CHE.
A question on qualifications and assessment. I hope you're not forgetting.
Chair and members, thank you for this opportunity. In terms of national reviews for the Honourable Member, 17 refers to 17 site visits. So the number of institutions that offer a particular program, for example, social work, 16 universities offer social work. We would send a panel of peers of 2 to 3 people for 1 or 2 days to actually look at the self-evaluation the institution's given and check what's going on the ground and speak with students and with staff and so on. So each national review would be made up of a number of site visits by different teams, and we largely run our quality assurance system on a peer-based model. It's a successful one, I think, and has contributed to the buy-in from our higher education system as a whole. So over the next 3 years, we would probably only be able to run 1, 2, or 3 national reviews, but each one of those would constitute particular visits to institutions, depending on who's offering that particular qualification. With respect to monitoring standards and qualifications, it is part of our job, and it is an ongoing challenge. I remember a previous CEO of the CHE getting a query of a student who had graduated from one university not being accepted by another university at postgraduate level because the other university didn't think that the qualification that that student had received was at the appropriate level. I think that's an ongoing discussion that's particularly needed in the country and particularly by HESA. The caveat on that, of course, is every university, according to its own legislation, can set its own admission requirements. But there is things like senatory discretion and so on to allow students in. But it's very difficult for the CHE to, apart from raise the question with institutions and say on what basis and where's the transparency around the kinds of issues of students being able to articulate or move to different institutions as they do different qualifications and so on. But I think it is a challenge not only in South Africa, but I think internationally as well, particularly when you're dealing with issues of institutional reputation. And I think that's where the whole issue of us as the CHE ensuring through our qualifications framework and the alignment of all programs to that, that all institutions meet the minimum requirements for quality in all of the programs. And if we can assert that, I think there's a strong case to say, well, on what basis would you not take this graduate from your institution? But it is a challenge. I think that's the three that I would deal with, but maybe members want to raise.
The question on physics, I mean, I think what the outcome of that project would be, that if there's a need then to look at what the link between what the challenge of teaching, say, undergraduate physics is linked to the school system, then we would have to appropriately take that up with the DB.
Okay, Chairperson, through you. I think the CEO in his opening, I think he highlighted, he gave an overview of the current constraints we have in terms of attracting capacity. And I think we have in the process been working out a number of initiatives to really come up with ways of addressing this. One of those is where we're seconding, you know, candidates from institutions to come and assist us. But to answer your question, the staff complement we have is 54, and out of those we have 12 unfilled positions, which is 22%. Six of those positions, because by virtue of the fact that the in our institutional audits we had additional staff in terms of administration, there was a decision that we need to put those on hold. We are in the process of filling the rest of the position, which is six positions. So we're hoping to really address the issue.
Chair, if I may also just respond specifically to the member's question. The CHE is a knowledge-based organization. That's really our bread and butter. And so retaining competent, qualified people in quality assurance who understand higher education, can engage in that area, is probably our most significant challenge. It's not at the administrative level. It's actually at the level of doing quality assurance and research and so on. That's our most significant challenge, and that's part of what our CEO was saying in terms of retaining the right kinds of people who can help with the transformation of higher education in our country.
I think this brings us to the end of the meeting. We accept your plan and budget, and we only hope that there will be a discussion. We should think of an environment where you could have a meeting of CHE, of ESA, of science and technology, higher education, and to speak on the issue of an appropriate level of lecturer, of professor, of experts in CHE, of an amount relevant for a student doing a doctoral study. We need to really begin that engagement at a high level, and to assist that process would require preparedness on your part as to what is the benchmarking that is the internationally, be either abroad or in Africa and elsewhere, so that we're able to forge forward in this debate. It must not just be a debate that is left at this stage, because in the end, the public service will turn into a university. Is this possible? Well, then the experts will be there, and they will start researching in the public service, and they'll start really lecturing us in the public service. And then our children will not go to university, will go to the public sector. So you must think of that situation happening naturally, not even precipitated by any person from any quarter. Just a natural development. Now, this brings us to the end of the meeting. Thank you, colleagues. We are only five remaining. We can take important decisions in the absence of our colleagues. They send apologies. They are going to various meetings. But we 15 minutes into lunch, so it means there's no lunch. We're going to the external public committees. Thank you very much.
No, I didn't see. No, the PM should pass that. Give up with the character of questions.